The Man in the Iron Mask. Chapter 1. The Prisoner. Since Aramis's singular transformation into a confessor of the order, Baisemeaux was no longer the same man. Up to that period, the place which Aramis had held in the worthy governor's estimation was that of a prelate whom he respected and a friend to whom he owed a debt of gratitude, but now he felt himself an inferior, and that Aramis was his master. He himself lighted a lantern, summoned a turnkey, and said, returning to Aramis, "I am at your orders, Monseigneur." Aramis merely nodded his head, as much as to say, "Very good," and signed to him with his hand to lead the way. Baisemeaux advanced, and Aramis followed him. It was a calm and lovely starlit night, the steps of three men resounded on the flags of the terraces, and the clinking of the keys hanging from the jailer's girdle made itself heard up to the stories of the towers, as if to remind the prisoners that the liberty of earth was luxury beyond their reach. It might have been said that the alteration effected in Baisemeaux extended even to the prisoners. The turnkey, the same who, on Aramis's first arrival had shown himself so inquisitive and curious, was now not only silent, but impassible. He held his head down, and seemed afraid to keep his ears open. In this wise they reached the basement of the Bertaudiere, the two first stories of which were mounted silently and somewhat slowly, for Baisemeaux, though far from disobeying, was far from exhibiting any eagerness to obey. On arriving at the door, Baisemeaux showed a disposition to enter the prisoner's chamber, but Aramis, stopping him on the threshold, said, "The rules do not allow the governor to hear the prisoner's confession." Baisemeaux bowed, and made way for Aramis, who took the lantern and entered, and then signed to them to close the door behind him. For an instant he remained standing, listening whether Baisemeaux and the turnkey had retired, but as soon as he was assured by the sound of their descending footsteps that they had left the tower, he put the lantern on the table and gazed around. On a bed of green serge, similar in all respect to the other beds in the Bastille, save that it was newer, and under curtains half-drawn, reposed a young man, to whom we have already once before introduced Aramis. According to custom, the prisoner was without a light. At the hour of curfew, he was bound to extinguish his lamp, and we perceive how much he was favored, in being allowed to keep it burning even till then. Near the bed a large leathern armchair, with twisted legs, sustained his clothes. A little table without pens, books, paper, or ink stood neglected in sadness near the window, while several plates, still unemptied, showed that the prisoner had scarcely touched his evening meal. Aramis saw that the young man was stretched upon his bed, his face half concealed by his arms. The arrival of a visitor did not cause any change of position, either he was waiting in expectation, or was asleep. Aramis lighted the candle from the lantern, pushed back the armchair, and approached the bed with an evident mixture of interest and respect. The young man raised his head. "What is it?" said he. "You desired a confessor?" replied Aramis. "Yes." "Because you are ill?" "Yes." "Very ill?" The young man gave Aramis a piercing glance, and answered, "I thank you." After a moment's silence, "I have seen you before," he continued. Aramis bowed. Doubtless the scrutiny the prisoner had just made of the cold, crafty, and imperious character stamped upon the features of the Bishop of Vannes was little reassuring to one in his situation, for he added, "I am better." "And so?" said Aramis. "Why, then being better, I have no longer the same need of a confessor, I think." "Not even of the haircloth, which the note you found in your bread informed you of?" The young man started, but before he had either assented or denied, Aramis continued, "Not even of the ecclesiastic from whom you were to hear an important revelation?" "If it be so," said the young man, sinking again on his pillow, "it is different, I am listening." Aramis then looked at him more closely, and was struck with the easy majesty of his mien, one which can never be acquired unless heaven has implanted it in the blood or heart. "Sit down, monsieur," said the prisoner. Aramis bowed and obeyed. "How does the Bastille agree with you?" asked the bishop. "Very well." "You do not suffer?"
"No."
"You have nothing to regret?"
"Nothing."
"Not even your liberty?"
"What do you call liberty, monsieur?" asked the prisoner, with the tone of a man who is preparing for a struggle.
"I call liberty, the flowers, the air, light, the stars, the happiness of going whithersoever the sinewy limbs of 1 in 20 chance to wish to carry you." The young man smiled, whether in resignation or contempt, it was difficult to tell. "Look," said he, "I have in the Japanese vase 2 roses gathered yesterday evening in the bud from the governor's garden. This morning they have blown and spread their vermilion chalice beneath my gaze, with every opening petal they unfold the treasures of their perfumes, filling my chamber with a fragrance that embalms it.
Look now on these two roses, even among roses these are beautiful, and the rose is the most beautiful of flowers. Why, then, do you bid me desire other flowers when I possess the loveliest of all?" Aramis gazed at the young man in surprise. "If flowers constitute liberty," sadly resumed the captive, "I am free, for I possess them." "But the air," cried Aramis, "air is so necessary to life." "Well, monsieur," returned the prisoner, "draw near to the window, it is open. Between high heaven and earth the wind whirls on its waftages of hail and lightning, exhales its torrid mist or breathes in gentle breezes. It caresses my face. When mounted on the back of this armchair, with my arm around the bars of the window to sustain myself, I fancy I am swimming the wide expanse before me." The countenance of Aramis darkened as the young man continued, "Light I have. What is better than light? I have the sun, a friend who comes to visit me every day without the permission of the governor or the jailer's company. He comes in at the window, and traces in my room a square the shape of the window, which lights up the hangings of my bed and floods the very floor. This luminous square increases from 10 o'clock till midday, and decreases from 1 till 3 slowly, as if, having hastened to my presence, it sorrowed at bidding me farewell. When its last ray disappears I have enjoyed its presence for 5 hours. Is not that sufficient? I have been told that there are unhappy beings who dig in quarries, and laborers who toil in mines, who never behold it at all." Aramis wiped the drops from his brow. "As to the stars which are so delightful to view," continued the young man, "they all resemble each other save in size and brilliancy. I am a favored mortal, for if you had not lighted that candle you would have been able to see the beautiful stars which I was gazing at from my couch before your arrival, whose silvery rays were stealing through my brain." Aramis lowered his head, he felt himself overwhelmed with the bitter flow of that sinister philosophy which is the religion of the captive. "So much, then, for the flowers, the air, the daylight, and the stars," tranquilly continued the young man, "there remains but exercise. Do I not walk all day in the governor's garden if it is fine here if it rains? In the fresh air if it is warm, in perfect warmth, thanks to my winter stove, if it be cold? Ah! Monsieur, do you fancy," continued the prisoner, not without bitterness, "that men have not done everything for me that a man can hope for or desire?" "Men," said Aramis, "be it so, but it seems to me you are forgetting heaven." "Indeed I have forgotten heaven," murmured the prisoner, with emotion, "but why do you mention it? Of what use is it to talk to a prisoner of heaven?" Aramis looked steadily at this singular youth, who possessed the resignation of a martyr with the smile of an atheist. "Is not heaven in everything?" he murmured in a reproachful tone. "Say rather, at the end of everything," answered the prisoner, firmly. "Be it so," said Aramis, "but let us return to our starting point." "I ask nothing better," returned the young man. "I am your confessor." "Yes." "Well, then, you ought, as a penitent, to tell me the truth." "My whole desire is to tell it you. Every prisoner has committed some crime for which he has been imprisoned. What crime, then, have you committed?" "You asked me the same question the first time you saw me," returned the prisoner. "And then, as now, you evaded giving me an answer." "And what reason have you for thinking that I shall now reply to you?" "Because this time I am your confessor." "Then if you wish me to tell what crime I have committed, explain to me in what a crime consists. For as my conscience does not accuse me, I aver that I am not a criminal. We are often criminals in the sight of the great of the earth, not alone for having ourselves committed crimes, but because we know that crimes have been committed." The prisoner manifested the deepest attention. "Yes, I understand you," he said, after a pause, "yes, you are right, monsieur, it is very possible that, in such a light, I am a criminal in the eyes of the great of the earth." "Ah! Then you know something," said Aramis, who thought he had pierced not merely through a defect in the harness, but through the joints of it. "No, I am not aware of anything," replied the young man, "but sometimes I think and I say to myself." "What do you say to yourself?" "That if I were to think but a little more deeply I should either go mad or I should divine a great deal." And then? Said Aramis, impatiently. "Then I leave off."
"You leave off?"
"Yes, my head becomes confused and my ideas melancholy, I feel ennui overtaking me, I wish."
"What?"
"I don't know, but I do not like to give myself up to longing for things which I do not possess, when I am so happy with what I have."
"You are afraid of death?" said Aramis, with a slight uneasiness.
"Yes," said the young man, smiling. Aramis felt the chill of that smile, and shuddered.
"Oh, as you fear death, you know more about matters than you say," he cried.
"And you,"
returned the prisoner, who bade me to ask to see you, you, who, when I did ask to see you, came here promising a world of confidence, how is it that, nevertheless, it is you who are silent, leaving it for me to speak? Since, then, we both wear masks, either let us both retain them or put them aside together. Aramis felt the force and justice of the remark, saying to himself, this is no ordinary man, I must be cautious. Are you ambitious? Said he suddenly to the prisoner, aloud, without preparing him for the alteration. What do you mean by ambitious? Replied the youth. Ambition, replied Aramis, is the feeling which prompts a man to desire more, much more than he possesses. I said that I was contented, monsieur, but, perhaps, I deceive myself. I am ignorant of the nature of ambition, but it is not impossible I may have some. Tell me your mind, that is all I ask. An ambitious man, said Aramis, is one who covets that which is beyond his station. I covet nothing beyond my station, said the young man, with an assurance of manner which for the second time made the Bishop of Vannes tremble. He was silent. But to look at the kindling eye, the knitted brow, and the reflective attitude of the captive, it was evident that he expected something more than silence, a silence which Aramis now broke. You lied the first time I saw you, said he. Lied! Cried the young man, starting up on his couch, with such a tone in his voice, and such a lightning in his eyes, that Aramis recoiled, in spite of himself. I should say, returned Aramis, bowing, you concealed from me what you knew of your infancy. A man's secrets are his own, monsieur, retorted the prisoner, and not at the mercy of the first chance comer. True, said Aramis, bowing still lower than before, 'tis true, pardon me, but today do I still occupy the place of a chance comer? I beseech you to reply, Monseigneur. This title slightly disturbed the prisoner, but nevertheless he did not appear astonished that it was given him. I do not know you, monsieur, said he. Oh, but if I dared, I would take your hand and kiss it. The young man seemed as if he were going to give Aramis his hand, but the light which beamed in his eyes faded away, and he coldly and distrustfully withdrew his hand again. Kiss the hand of a prisoner, he said, shaking his head, to what purpose? Why did you tell me, said Aramis, that you were happy here? Why, that you aspire to nothing? Why, in a word, by thus speaking, do you prevent me from being frank in my turn? The same light shone a third time in the young man's eyes, but died ineffectually away as before. You distrust me, said Aramis. And why say you so, monsieur? Oh, for a very simple reason, if you know what you ought to know, you ought to mistrust everybody. Then do not be astonished that I am mistrustful, since you suspect me of knowing what I do not know. Aramis was struck with admiration at this energetic resistance. Oh, Monseigneur! You drive me to despair, said he, striking the armchair with his fist. And, on my part, I do not comprehend you, monsieur. Well, then, try to understand me. The prisoner looked fixedly at Aramis. Sometimes it seems to me, said the latter, that I have before me the man whom I seek, and then. And then your man disappears, is it not so? Said the prisoner, smiling. So much the better. Aramis rose. Certainly, said he, I have nothing further to say to a man who mistrusts me as you do. And I, monsieur, said the prisoner, in the same tone, have nothing to say to a man who will not understand that a prisoner ought to be mistrustful of everybody. Even of his old friends, said Aramis. Oh, Monseigneur, you are too prudent. Of my old friends? You one of my old friends, you? Do you no longer remember, said Aramis, that you once saw, in the village where your early years were spent? Do you know the name of the village? Asked the prisoner. Noisy-le-Sec, Monseigneur, answered Aramis, firmly. Go on, said the young man, with an immovable aspect. Stay, Monseigneur, said Aramis, if you are positively resolved to carry on this game, let us break off. I am here to tell you many things, 'tis true, but you must allow me to see that, on your side, you have a desire to know them. Before revealing the important matters I still withhold, be assured I am in need of some encouragement, if not candor, a little sympathy, if not confidence. But you keep yourself entrenched in a pretended which paralyzes me. Oh, not for the reason you think, for, ignorant as you may be, or indifferent as you feign to be, you are nonetheless what you are, Monseigneur, and there is nothing, mark me, which can cause you not to be so. I promise you, replied the prisoner, to hear you without impatience. Only it appears to me that I have a right to repeat the question I have already asked, who are you? Do you remember, 15 or 18 years ago, seeing at Noisy La Seca Cavalier, accompanied by a lady in black silk, with flame-colored ribbons in her hair?
Yes, said the young man, I once asked the name of this cavalier, and they told me that he called himself the Abbé d'Herblay. I was astonished that the abbé had so warlike an air, and they replied that there was nothing singular in that, seeing that he was one of Louis XIII's musketeers.
Well, said Aramis, that musketeer and abbé, afterwards Bishop of Vannes, is your confessor now.
I know it, I recognized you.
Then, Monseigneur, if you know that, I must further add a fact of which you are ignorant, that if the king were to know this evening of the presence of this musketeer, this abbé, this bishop, this confessor, here he, who has risked everything to visit you, tomorrow would behold the steely glitter of the executioner's axe in a dungeon more gloomy, more obscure than yours.
While listening to these words, delivered with emphasis, the young man had raised himself on his couch, and was now gazing more and more eagerly at Aramis. The result of his scrutiny was that he appeared to derive some confidence from it.
Yes, he murmured, I remember perfectly. The woman of whom you speak came once with you, and twice afterwards with another.
He hesitated.
With another, who came to see you every month, is it not so, Monseigneur?
Yes.
Do you know who this lady was?
The light seemed ready to flash from the prisoner's eyes.
I am aware that she was one of the ladies of the court, he said.
You remember that lady well, do you not?
Oh, my recollection can hardly be very confused on this head, said the young prisoner. I saw that lady once with a gentleman about 45 years old. I saw her once with you, and with the lady dressed in black. I have seen her twice since then with the same person. These four people, with my master, and old Perronnette, my jailer, and the governor of the prison, are the only persons with whom I have ever spoken, and, indeed, almost the only persons I have ever seen.
Then you were in prison?
If I am a prisoner here, then I was comparatively free, although in a very narrow sense a house I never quitted, a garden surrounded with walls I could not climb, these constituted my residence, but you know it, as you have been there. In a word, being accustomed to live within these bounds, I never cared to leave them. And so you will understand, monsieur, that having never seen anything of the world, I have nothing left to care for, and therefore, if you relate anything, you will be obliged to explain each item to me as you go along.
And I will do so, said Aramis, bowing, for it is my duty, Monseigneur.
Well, then, begin by telling me who was my tutor.
A worthy and, above all, an honorable gentleman, Monseigneur, fit guide for both body and soul.
Had you ever any reason to complain of him?
Oh, no, quite the contrary. But this gentleman of yours often used to tell me that my father and mother were dead.
Did he deceive me, or did he speak the truth?
He was compelled to comply with the orders given him.
Then he lied?
In one respect.
Your father is dead.
And my mother?
She is dead for you.
But then she lives for others, does she not?
Yes.
And I, then, the young man looked sharply at Aramis, am compelled to live in the obscurity of a prison?
Alas! I fear so.
And that because my presence in the world would lead to the revelation of a great secret?
Certainly, a very great secret.
My enemy must indeed be powerful, to be able to shut up in the Bastille a child such as I then was.
He is.
More powerful than my mother, then?
And why do you ask that?
Because my mother would have taken my part.
Aramis hesitated.
Yes, Monseigneur, more powerful than your mother.
Seeing, then, that my nurse and preceptor were carried off, and that I, also, was separated from them, either they were, or I am, very dangerous to my enemy.
Yes, but you are alluding to a peril from which he freed himself, by causing the nurse and preceptor to disappear, answered Aramis, quietly.
Disappear! Cried the prisoner, how did they disappear?
In a very sure way, answered Aramis, they are dead.
The young man turned pale, and passed his hand tremblingly over his face.
Poison?
He asked.
Poison.
The prisoner reflected a moment. My enemy must indeed have been very cruel, or hard beset by necessity, to assassinate those two innocent people, my sole support, for the worthy gentleman and the poor nurse had never harmed a living being.
In your family, Monseigneur, necessity is stern. And so it is necessity which compels me, to my great regret, to tell you that this gentleman and the unhappy lady have been assassinated.
Oh, you tell me nothing I am not aware of, said the prisoner, knitting his brows.
How?
I suspected it.
Why?
I will tell you. At this moment the young man, supporting himself on his two elbows, drew close to Aramis's face, with such an expression of dignity, of self-command and of defiance even, that the bishop felt the electricity of enthusiasm strike in devouring flashes from that great heart of his, into his brain of adamant.
"Speak, Monsignor. I have already told you that by conversing with you I endanger my life. Little value as it has, I implore you to accept it as the ransom of your own."
"Well," resumed the young man, "this is why I suspected they had killed my nurse and my preceptor."
"Whom you used to call your father?"
"Yes, whom I called my father, but whose son I well knew I was not."
"Who caused you to suppose so?"
"Just as you, monsieur, are too respectful for a friend, he was also too respectful for a father."
"I, however," said Aramis, "have no intention to disguise myself."
The young man nodded assent and continued, "Undoubtedly, I was not destined to perpetual seclusion," said the prisoner, "and that which makes me believe so, above all, now, is the care that was taken to render me as accomplished a cavalier as possible. The gentleman attached to my person taught me everything he knew himself: mathematics, a little geometry, astronomy, fencing and riding. Every morning I went through military exercises, and practiced on horseback. Well, one morning during the summer, it being very hot, I went to sleep in the hall. Nothing, up to that period, except the respect paid me, had enlightened me, or even roused my suspicions. I lived as children, as birds, as plants, as the air and the sun do. I had just turned my 15th year."
"This, then, is 8 years ago?"
"Yes, nearly, but I have ceased to reckon time."
"Excuse me, but what did your tutor tell you, to encourage you to work?"
"He used to say that a man was bound to make for himself, in the world, that fortune which heaven had refused him at his birth. He added that, being a poor, obscure orphan, I had no one but myself to look to, and that nobody either did, or ever would, take any interest in me. I was, then, in the hall I have spoken of, asleep from fatigue with long fencing. My preceptor was in his room on the first floor, just over me. Suddenly I heard him exclaim, and then he called, 'Perronnette! Perronnette!' It was my nurse whom he called."
"Yes, I know it," said Aramis.
"Continue, Monsignor."
"Very likely she was in the garden, for my preceptor came hastily downstairs. I rose, anxious at seeing him anxious. He opened the garden door, still crying out, 'Perronnette! Perronnette!' The windows of the hall looked into the court, the shutters were closed, but through a chink in them I saw my tutor draw near a large well, which was almost directly under the windows of his study. He stooped over the brim, looked into the well, and again cried out, and made wild and affrighted gestures. Where I was, I could not only see, but hear and see, and here I did."
"Go on, I pray you," said Aramis.
"Dame Perronnette came running up, hearing the governor's cries. He went to meet her, took her by the arm, and drew her quickly towards the edge, after which, as they both bent over it together, 'Look, look,' cried he, 'what a misfortune!'"
calm yourself," said Perronnette, "what is the matter?"
"The letter," he exclaimed, "do you see that letter?" pointing to the bottom of the well.
"What letter?" she cried.
"The letter you see down there, the last letter from the queen."
At this word I trembled. My tutor, he who passed for my father, he who was continually recommending me modesty and humility in correspondence with the queen.
"The queen's last letter," cried Perronnette, without showing more astonishment than at seeing this letter at the bottom of the well, "but how came it there?"
"A chance, Dame Perronnette, a singular chance. I was entering my room, and on opening the door, the window, too, being open, a puff of air came suddenly and carried off this paper, this letter of Her Majesty's. I darted after it, and gained the window just in time to see it flutter a moment in the breeze and disappear down the well."
"Well," said Dame Perronnette, "and if the letter has fallen into the well, 'tis all the same as if it was burned, and as the queen burns all her letters every time she comes."
"And so you see this lady who came every month was the queen," said the prisoner.
"Doubtless, doubtless," continued the old gentleman, "but this letter contained instructions. How can I follow them?"
"Write immediately to her, give her a plain account of the accident, and the queen will no doubt write you another letter in place of this."
"Oh! The queen would never believe the story," said the good gentleman, shaking his head. "She will imagine that I wanted to keep this letter instead of giving it up like the rest, so as to have a hold over her. She is so distrustful, and M. de Mazarin, so yon devil of an Italian, is capable of having us poisoned at the first breath of suspicion."
Aramis almost imperceptibly smiled.
"You know, Dame Perronnette,
They are both so suspicious in all that concerns Philippe.
Philippe was the name they gave me, said the prisoner.
Well, 'tis no use hesitating, said Dame Perronnette, somebody must go down the well.
Of course, so that the person who goes down may read the paper as he is coming up.
But let us choose some villager who cannot read, and then you will be at ease.
Granted, but will not anyone who descends guess that a paper must be important for which we risk a man's life?
However, you have given me an idea, Dame Perronnette, somebody shall go down the well, but that somebody shall be myself.
But at this notion Dame Perronnette lamented and cried in such a manner, and so implored the old nobleman, with tears in her eyes, that he promised her to obtain a ladder long enough to reach down, while she went in search of some stout-hearted youth, whom she was to persuade that a jewel had fallen into the well, and that this jewel was wrapped in a paper.
And as paper, remarked my preceptor, naturally unfolds in water, the young man would not be surprised at finding nothing, after all, but the letter wide open.
But perhaps the writing will be already effaced by that time, said Dame Perronnette.
No consequence, provided we secure the letter. On returning it to the Queen, she will see at once that we have not betrayed her, and consequently, as we shall not rouse the distrust of Mazarin, we shall have nothing to fear from him.
Having come to this resolution, they parted. I pushed back the shutter, and, seeing that my tutor was about to re-enter, I threw myself on my couch, in a confusion of brain caused by all I had just heard.
My governor opened the door a few moments after, and thinking I was asleep gently closed it again. As soon as ever it was shut, I rose, and, listening, heard the sound of retiring footsteps. Then I returned to the shutters, and saw my tutor and Dame Perronnette go out together. I was alone in the house. They had hardly closed the gate before I sprang from the window and ran to the well. Then, just as my governor had leaned over, so leaned I, something white and luminous glistened in the green and quivering silence of the water. The brilliant disc fascinated and allured me, my eyes became fixed, and I could hardly breathe. The well seemed to draw me downwards with its slimy mouth and icy breath, and I thought I read, at the bottom of the water, characters of fire traced upon the letter the Queen had touched. Then, scarcely knowing what I was about, and urged on by one of those instinctive impulses which drive men to destruction, I lowered the cord from the windlass of the well to within about 3 feet of the water, leaving the bucket dangling, at the same time taking infinite pains not to disturb that coveted letter, which was beginning to change its white tint for the hue of chrysoprase, proof enough that it was sinking, and then, with the rope weltering in my hands, slid down into the abyss. When I saw myself hanging over the dark pool, when I saw the sky lessening above my head, a cold shudder came over me, a chill fear got the better of me, I was seized with giddiness, and the hair rose on my head, but my strong will still reigned supreme over all the terror and disquietude. I gained the water, and at once plunged into it, holding on by one hand, while I immersed the other and seized the dear letter, which, alas, came in my grasp. I concealed the two fragments in my body coat, and, helping myself with my feet against the sides of the pit, and clinging on with my hands, agile and vigorous as I was, and, above all, pressed for time, I regained the brink, drenching it as I touched it with the water that streamed off me. I was no sooner out of the well with my prize, than I rushed into the sunlight, and took refuge in a kind of shrubbery at the bottom of the garden. As I entered my hiding place, the bell which resounded when the great gate was opened, rang. It was my preceptor come back again. I had but just time. I calculated that it would take 10 minutes before he would gain my place of concealment, even if, guessing where I was, he came straight to it, and 20 if he were obliged to look for me. But this was time enough to allow me to read the cherished letter, whose fragments I hastened to unite again. The writing was already fading, but I managed to decipher it all.
And will you tell me what you read therein, Monseigneur? Asked Aramis, deeply interested.
Quite enough, monsieur, to see that my tutor was a man of noble rank, and that Perronnette, without being a lady of quality, was far better than a servant, and also to perceive that I must myself be high-born, since the Queen, Anne of Austria, and Mazarin, the Prime Minister, commended me so earnestly to their care. Here the young man paused, quite overcome.
And what happened? Asked Aramis.
It happened, monsieur, answered he, that the workmen they had summoned found nothing in the well, after the closest search, that my governor perceived that the brink was all watery, that I was not so dried by the sun as to prevent Dame Perronnette spying that my garments were moist, and, lastly, that I was seized with a violent fever, owing to the chill and the excitement of my discovery, an attack of delirium supervening, during which I related the whole adventure, so that, guided by my avowal, my governor found the pieces of the Queen's letter inside the bolster where I had concealed them.
Ah, said Aramis, now I understand. Beyond this, all is conjecture. Doubtless the unfortunate lady and gentleman, not daring to keep the occurrence secret, wrote of all this to the queen and sent back the torn letter. After which, said Aramis, you were arrested and removed to the Bastille. As you see. Your two attendants disappeared? Alas! Let us not take up our time with the dead, but see what can be done with the living. You told me you were resigned. I repeat it. Without any desire for freedom? As I told you. Without ambition, sorrow, or thought? The young man made no answer. Well, asked Aramis, why are you silent? I think I have spoken enough, answered the prisoner, and that now it is your turn. I am weary. Aramis gathered himself up, and a shade of deep solemnity spread itself over his countenance. It was evident that he had reached the crisis in the part he had come to the prison to play. One question, said Aramis. What is it? Speak. In the house you inhabited there were neither looking glasses nor mirrors? What are those two words, and what is their meaning? Asked the young man, I have no sort of knowledge of them. They designate two pieces of furniture which reflect objects, so that, for instance, you may see in them your own lineaments, as you see mine now, with the naked eye. No, there was neither a glass nor a mirror in the house, answered the young man. Aramis looked round him. Nor is there anything of the kind here, either, he said, they had again taken the same precaution. To what end? You will know directly. Now, you have told me that you were instructed in mathematics, astronomy, fencing, and writing, but you have not said a word about history. My tutor sometimes related to me the principal deeds of the King, St. Louis, King Francis I, and King Henry IV. Is that all? Very nearly. This also was done by design, then, just as they deprived you of mirrors, which reflect the present, so they left you in ignorance of history, which reflects the past. Since your imprisonment, books have been forbidden you, so that you are unacquainted with a number of facts, by means of which you would be able to reconstruct the shattered mansion of your recollections and your hopes. It is true, said the young man. Listen, then, I will in a few words tell you what has passed in France during the last 23 or 24 years, that is, from the probable date of your birth, in a word, from the time that interests you. Say on. And the young man resumed his serious and attentive attitude. Do you know who is the son of Henry IV? At least I know who his successor was. How? By means of a coin dated 1610, which bears the effigy of Henry IV, and another of 1612, bearing that of Louis XIII. So I presumed that, there being only 2 years between the two dates, Louis was Henry's successor. Then, said Aramis, you know that the last reigning monarch was Louis XIII? I do, answered the youth, slightly reddening. Well, he was a prince full of noble ideas and great projects, always, alas, deferred by the trouble of the times and the dread struggle that his minister Richelieu had to maintain against the great nobles of France. The king himself was of a feeble character, and died young and unhappy. I know it. He had been long anxious about having an heir, a care which weighs heavily on princes, who desire to leave behind them more than one pledge that their best thoughts and works will be continued. Did the king, then, die childless? Asked the prisoner, smiling. No, but he was long without one, and for a long while thought he should be the last of his race. This idea had reduced him to the depths of despair, when suddenly, his wife, Anne of Austria. The prisoner trembled. Did you know, said Aramis, that Louis XIII's wife was called Anne of Austria? Continue, said the young man, without replying to the question. When suddenly, resumed Aramis, the queen announced an interesting event. There was great joy at the intelligence, and all prayed for her happy delivery. On the 5th of September, 1638, she gave birth to a son. Here Aramis looked at his companion, and thought he observed him turning pale. You are about to hear, said Aramis, an account which few indeed could now avouch, for it refers to a secret which they imagined buried with the dead, entombed in the abyss of the confessional. And you will tell me this secret? Broke in the youth. Oh! Said Aramis, with unmistakable emphasis, I do not know that I ought to risk this secret by entrusting it to one who has no desire to quit the Bastille. I hear you, monsieur. The queen, then, gave birth to a son. But while the court was rejoicing over the event, when the king had shown the newborn child to the nobility and people, and was sitting gaily down to table, to celebrate the event, the queen, who was alone in her room,
was again taken ill and gave birth to a second son.
"Oh," said the prisoner, betraying a better acquaintance with affairs than he had owned to, "I thought that Monsieur was only born in."
Aramis raised his finger. "Permit me to continue," he said. The prisoner sighed impatiently, and paused.
"Yes," said Aramis, "the queen had a second son, whom Dame Perronnette, the midwife, received in her arms."
"Dame Perronnette," murmured the young man. They ran at once to the banqueting room, and whispered to the king what had happened. He rose and quitted the table. But this time it was no longer happiness that his face expressed, but something akin to terror. The birth of twins changed into bitterness the joy to which that of an only son had given rise, seeing that in France, a fact you are assuredly ignorant of, it is the oldest of the king's sons who succeeds his father.
"I know it."
"And that the doctors and jurists assert that there is ground for doubting whether the son that first makes his appearance is the elder by the law of heaven and of nature." The prisoner uttered a smothered cry, and became whiter than the coverlet under which he hid himself. "Now you understand," pursued Aramis, "that the king, who with so much pleasure saw himself repeated in one, was in despair about two, fearing that the second might dispute the first's claim to seniority, which had been recognized only 2 hours before, and so this second son, relying on party interests and caprices, might one day sow discord and engender civil war throughout the kingdom, by these means destroying the very dynasty he should have strengthened."
"Oh, I understand. I understand," murmured the young man.
"Well," continued Aramis, "this is what they relate, what they declare. This is why one of the queen's two sons, shamefully parted from his brother, shamefully sequestered, is buried in profound obscurity. This is why that second son has disappeared, and so completely, that not a soul in France, save his mother, is aware of his existence."
"Yes. His mother, who has cast him off," cried the prisoner in a tone of despair.
"Except, also," Aramis went on, "the lady in the black dress, and, finally, excepting."
"Excepting yourself, is it not? You who come and relate all this, you, who rouse in my soul curiosity, hatred, ambition, and, perhaps, even the thirst of vengeance, except you, monsieur, who, if you are the man to whom I expect, whom the note I have received applies to, whom, in short, heaven ought to send me, must possess about you."
"What?" asked Aramis.
"A portrait of the king, Louis XIV, who at this moment reigns upon the throne of France."
"Here is the portrait," replied the bishop, handing the prisoner a miniature in enamel, on which Louis was depicted lifelike, with a handsome, lofty mien. The prisoner eagerly seized the portrait, and gazed at it with devouring eyes.
"And now, Monseigneur," said Aramis, "here is a mirror."
Aramis left the prisoner time to recover his ideas.
So high," murmured the young man, eagerly comparing the likeness of Louis with his own countenance reflected in the glass.
"What do you think of it?" at length said Aramis.
"I think that I am lost," replied the captive. "The king will never set me free."
"And I demand to know," added the bishop, fixing his piercing eye significantly upon the prisoner, "I demand to know which of these two is king, the one this miniature portrays, or whom the glass reflects."
"The king, monsieur," sadly replied the young man, "is he who is on the throne, who is not in prison, and who, on the other hand, can cause others to be entombed there. Royalty means power, and you behold how powerless I am."
"Monseigneur," answered Aramis, with a respect he had not yet manifested, "the king, mark me, will, if you desire it, be the one that, quitting his dungeon, shall maintain himself upon the throne, on which his friends will place him."
"Tempt me not, monsieur," broke in the prisoner bitterly.
"Be not weak, Monseigneur," persisted Aramis. "I have brought you all the proofs of your birth, consult them, satisfy yourself that you are a king's son, it is for us to act."
"No, no, it is impossible.
Unless, indeed," resumed the bishop ironically, "it be the destiny of your race, that the brothers excluded from the throne should be always princes void of courage and honesty, as was your uncle, and Gaston d'Orléans, who 10 times conspired against his brother Louis XIII.
"What?" cried the prince, astonished.
"My uncle Gaston conspired against his brother, conspired to dethrone him?"
"Exactly, Monseigneur, for no other reason. I tell you the truth."
"And he had friends, devoted friends?"
"As much so as I am to you."
"And, after all, what did he do?"
"Failed."
"He failed, I admit, but always through his own fault, and, for the sake of purchasing not his life, for the life of the king's brother is sacred and inviolable, but his liberty, he sacrificed the lives of all his friends, one after another. And so, at this day, he is a very blot on history, the detestation of 100 noble families in this kingdom. I understand, monsieur, either by weakness or treachery, my uncle slew his friends. By weakness, which, in princes, is always treachery. And cannot a man fail, then, from incapacity and ignorance? Do you really believe it possible that a poor captive such as I, brought up, not only at a distance from the court, but even from the world, do you believe it possible that such a one could assist those of his friends who should attempt to serve him? And as Aramis was about to reply, the young man suddenly cried out, with a violence which betrayed the temper of his blood, "We are speaking of friends, but how can I have any friends I, whom no one knows, and have neither liberty, money, nor influence, to gain any? I fancy I had the honor to offer myself to your Royal Highness."
"Oh, do not style me so, monsieur, 'tis either treachery or cruelty. Bid me not think of aught beyond these prison walls, which so grimly confine me. Let me again love, or, at least, submit to my slavery and my obscurity."
"Monseigneur, Monseigneur, if you again utter these desperate words, if, after having received proof of your high birth, you still remain poor-spirited in body and soul, I will comply with your desire, I will depart, and renounce forever the service of a master, to whom so eagerly I came to devote my assistance and my life."
"Monsieur," cried the prince, "would it not have been better for you to have reflected, before telling me all that you have done, that you have broken my heart forever?"
"And so I desire to do, Monseigneur. To talk to me about power, grandeur, aye, and to prate of thrones. Is a prison the fit place? You wish to make me believe in splendor, and we are lying lost in night. You boast of glory, and we are smothering our words in the curtains of this miserable bed. You give me glimpses of power absolute whilst I hear the footsteps of the every watchful jailer in the quarter, that step which, after all, makes you tremble more than it does me. To render me somewhat less incredulous, free me from the Bastille, let me breathe the fresh air, give me my spurs and trusty sword, then we shall begin to understand each other. It is precisely my intention to give you all this, Monseigneur, and more, only, do you desire it?"
"A word more," said the prince. "I know there are guards in every gallery, bolts to every door, cannon and soldiery at every barrier. How will you overcome the sentries, spike the guns? How will you break through the bolts and bars?"
"Monseigneur, how did you get the note which announced my arrival to you?"
"You can bribe a jailer for such a thing as a note. If we can corrupt one turnkey, we can corrupt 10.
"Well, I admit that it may be possible to release a poor captive from the Bastille, possible so to conceal him that the king's people shall not again ensnare him, possible, in some unknown retreat, to sustain the unhappy wretch in some suitable manner."
"Monseigneur," said Aramis, smiling, "I admit that, whoever would do this much for me, would seem more than mortal in my eyes, but as you tell me I am a prince, brother of the king, how can you restore me the rank and power which my mother and my brother have deprived me of? And as, to effect this, I must pass a life of war and hatred, how can you cause me to prevail in those combats, render me invulnerable by my enemies? Ah! Monsieur, reflect on all this, place me, tomorrow, in some dark cavern at a mountain's base, yield me the delight of hearing in freedom sounds of the river, plain and valley, of beholding in freedom the sun of the blue heavens, or the stormy sky, and it is enough. Promise me no more than this, for, indeed, more you cannot give, and it would be a crime to deceive me, since you call yourself my friend."
Aramis waited in silence.
"Monseigneur," he resumed, after a moment's reflection, "I admire the firm, sound sense which dictates your words. I am happy to have discovered my monarch's mind. Again, again. Oh, God! For mercy's sake," cried the prince, pressing his icy hands upon his clammy brow, "do not play with me. I have no need to be a king to be the happiest of men. But I, Monseigneur, wish you to be a king for the good of humanity."
"Ah," said the prince, with fresh distrust inspired by the word, "ah! With what, then, has humanity to reproach my brother? I forgot to say, Monseigneur, that if you would allow me to guide you, and if you consent to become the most powerful monarch in Christendom, you will have promoted the interests of all the friends whom I devote to the success of your cause, and these friends are numerous."
"Numerous?
Less numerous than powerful, Monseigneur. Explain yourself."
"It is impossible. I will explain, I swear before heaven, on that day that I see you sitting on the throne of France."
"But my brother?"
"You shall decree his fate. Do you pity him?"
"Him, who leads me to perish in a dungeon? No, no. For him I have no pity."
"So much the better. He might have himself come to this prison, have taken me by the hand, and have said, "My brother, heaven created us to love, not to contend with one another. I come to you. A barbarous prejudice has condemned you to pass your days in obscurity, far from mankind, deprived of every joy. I will make you sit down beside me, I will buckle round your waist our father's sword. Will you take advantage of this reconciliation to put down or restrain me? Will you employ that sword to spill my blood?"
"Oh, never," I would have replied to him, "I look on you as my preserver, I will respect you as my master. You give me far more than heaven bestowed, for through you I possess liberty and the privilege of loving and being loved in this world."
"And you would have kept your word, Monsignor?"
"On my life. While now that I have guilty ones to punish."
"In what manner, Monsignor? What do you say as to the resemblance that heaven has given me to my brother?"
"I say that there was in that likeness a providential instruction which the king ought to have heeded. I say that your mother committed a crime in rendering those different in happiness and fortune whom nature created so startlingly alike, of her own flesh, and I conclude that the object of punishment should be only to restore the equilibrium."
"By which you mean?"
"That if I restore you to your place on your brother's throne, he shall take yours in prison."
"Alas! There's such infinity of suffering in prison, especially it would be so for one who has drunk so deeply of the cup of enjoyment."
"Your Royal Highness will always be free to act as you may desire, and if it seems good to you, after punishment, you will have it in your power to pardon."
"Good. And now, are you aware of one thing, monsieur?"
"Tell me, my prince."
"It is that I will hear nothing further from you till I am clear of the Bastille. I was going to say to your highness that I should only have the pleasure of seeing you once again."
"And when?"
"The day when my prince leaves these gloomy walls."
"Heavens! How will you give me notice of it?"
"By myself coming to fetch you."
"Yourself?"
"My prince, do not leave this chamber save with me, or if in my absence you are compelled to do so, remember that I am not concerned in it. And so I am not to speak a word of this to anyone whatever, save to you?"
"Save only to me."
Aramis bowed very low. The prince offered his hand.
"Monsieur," he said, in a tone that issued from his heart, "one word more, my last. If you have sought me for my destruction, if you are only a tool in the hands of my enemies, if from our conference, in which you have sounded the depths of my mind, anything worse than captivity result, that is to say, if death befall me, still receive my blessing, for you will have ended my troubles and given me repose from the tormenting fever that has preyed on me for 8 long, weary years."
"Monsignor, wait the results ere you judge me," said Aramis.
"I say that, in such a case, I bless and forgive you. If, on the other hand, you are come to restore me to that position in the sunshine of fortune and glory to which I was destined by heaven, if by your means I am enabled to live in the memory of man, and confer luster on my race by deeds of valor, or by solid benefits bestowed upon my people, if, from my present depths of sorrow, aided by your generous hand, I raise myself to the very height of honor, then to you, whom I thank with blessings, to you I offer half my power and my glory, though you would still be but partly recompensed, and your share must always remain incomplete, since I could not divide with you the happiness received at your hands."
"Monsignor," replied Aramis, moved by the pallor and excitement of the young man, "the nobleness of your heart fills me with joy and admiration. It is not you who will have to thank me, but rather the nation whom you will render happy, the posterity whose name you will make glorious. Yes, I shall indeed have bestowed upon you more than life, I shall have given you immortality."
The prince offered his hand to Aramis, who sank upon his knee and kissed it.
"It is the first act of homage paid to our future king," said he. "When I see you again, I shall say, 'Good day, sire.'"
"Till then," said the young man, pressing his wan and wasted fingers over his heart, "till then, no more dreams, no more strain on my life, my heart would break. Oh, monsieur, how small is my prison, how low the window, how narrow are the doors. To think that so much pride, splendor, and happiness, should be able to enter in and to remain here."
"Your Royal Highness makes me proud," said Aramis, "since you infer it is I who brought all this." And he rapped immediately on the door. The jailer came to open it with Baisemeaux, who, devoured by fear and uneasiness, was beginning, in spite of himself, to listen at the door. Happily, neither of the speakers had forgotten to smother his voice, even in the most passionate outbreaks.
"What a confessor!" said the governor, forcing a laugh. "Who would believe that a compulsory recluse, a man as though in the very jaws of death, could have committed crimes so numerous, and so long to tell of?"
Aramis made no reply. He was eager to leave the Bastille, where the secret which overwhelmed him seemed to double the weight of the walls.
As soon as they reached Baisemeaux's quarters, "Let us proceed to business, my dear governor," said Aramis.
"Alas," replied Baisemeaux. "You have to ask me for my receipt for 150,000 livres, said the bishop.
"And to pay over the first third of the sum," added the poor governor, with a sigh, taking 3 steps towards his iron strongbox.
"Here is the receipt," said Aramis.
"And here is the money," returned Baisemeaux, with a threefold sigh.
"The order instructed me only to give a receipt, it said nothing about receiving the money," rejoined Aramis.
"Adieu, Monsieur le Gouverneur." And he departed, leaving Baisemeaux almost more than stifled with joy and surprise at this regal present so liberally bestowed by the confessor extraordinary to the Bastille.
Chapter 2. How Mustin had become fatter without giving Porthos notice thereof, and of the troubles which consequently befell that worthy gentleman. Since the departure of Athos for Blois, Porthos and D'Artagnan were seldom together. One was occupied with harassing duties for the king, the other had been making many purchases of furniture which he intended to forward to his estate, and by aid of which he hoped to establish in his various residences something of the courtly luxury he had witnessed in all its dazzling brightness in His Majesty's society. D'Artagnan, ever faithful, one morning during an interval of service thought about Porthos, and being uneasy at not having heard anything of him for a fortnight, directed his steps towards his hotel, and pounced upon him just as he was getting up. The worthy baron had a pensive, nay, more than pensive, melancholy air. He was sitting on his bed, only half-dressed, and with legs dangling over the edge, contemplating a host of garments, which with their fringes, lace, embroidery, and slashes of ill-assorted hues, were strewed all over the floor. Porthos, sat in reflective as La Fontaine's hair, did not observe D'Artagnan's entrance, which was, moreover, screened at this moment by M. Mustin, whose personal corpulency, quiet enough at any time to hide one man from another, was effectually doubled by a scarlet coat which the intendant was holding up for his master's inspection, by the sleeves, that he might the better see it all over. D'Artagnan stopped at the threshold and looked in at the pensive Porthos, and then, as the sight of the innumerable garments strewing the floor caused mighty sighs to heave the bosom of that excellent gentleman, D'Artagnan thought it time to put an end to these dismal reflections, and coughed by way of announcing himself.
"Ah!" exclaimed Porthos, whose countenance brightened with joy, "ah! Ah! Here is D'Artagnan. I shall then get hold of an idea." At these words Mustin, doubting what was going on behind him, got out of the way, smiling kindly at the friend of his master, who thus found himself freed from the material obstacle which had prevented his reaching D'Artagnan. Porthos made his sturdy knees crack again in rising, and crossing the room in 2 strides, found himself face to face with his friend, whom he folded to his breast with a force of affection that seemed to increase with every day.
"Ah!" he repeated, "you are always welcome, dear friend, but just now you are more welcome than ever."
"But you seem to have the megrims here," exclaimed D'Artagnan. Porthos replied by a look expressive of dejection.
"Well, then, tell me all about it, Porthos, my friend, unless it is a secret."
"In the first place," returned Porthos, "you know I have no secrets from you. This, then, is what saddens me."
"Wait a minute, Porthos, let me first get rid of all this litter of satin and velvet."
"Oh, never mind," said Porthos, contemptuously, "it is all trash."
"Trash, Porthos? Cloth at 25 livres an ell. Gorgeous satin. Regal velvet.
Then you think these clothes are
splendid, Porthos, splendid. I'll wager that you alone in France have so many, and suppose you never had any more made, and were to live to be 100 years of age, which wouldn't astonish me in the very least, you could still wear a new dress the day of your death, without being obliged to see the nose of a single tailor from now till then." Porthos shook his head.
"Come, my friend," said D'Artagnan, "this unnatural melancholy in you frightens me.
My dear Porthos, pray get it out, then. And the sooner the better."
"Yes, my friend, so I will, if, indeed, it is possible."
"Perhaps you have received bad news from Bracieux?"
"Number, they have felled the wood, and it has yielded a third more than the estimate."
"Then there has been a falling off in the pools of Purefoin?"
"No, my friend, they have been fished, and there is enough left to stock all the pools in the neighborhood."
"Perhaps your estate at Valen has been destroyed by an earthquake?"
"No, my friend, on the contrary, the ground was struck with lightning 100 paces from the chateau, and a fountain sprung up in a place entirely destitute of water."
"What in the world is the matter, then?"
"The fact is, I have received an invitation for the fated Vaux," said Porthos, with a lugubrious expression.
"Well,
Do you complain of that? The king has caused 100 mortal heartburnings among the courtiers by refusing invitations. And so, my dear friend, you are really going to Vaux?
Indeed I am.
You will see a magnificent sight.
Alas! I doubt it, though. Everything that is grand in France will be brought together there.
Ah! Cried Porthos, tearing out a lock of hair in his despair.
Eh! Good heavens, are you ill? Cried D'Artagnan.
I am as firm as the Pont Neuf. It isn't that.
But what is it, then?
'Tis that I have no clothes.
D'Artagnan stood petrified.
No clothes. Porthos, no clothes. He cried, when I see at least 50 suits on the floor.
50, truly, but not one which fits me.
What? Not one that fits you? But are you not measured, then, when you give an order?
To be sure he is, answered Mustin, but unfortunately I have gotten stouter.
What?
You stouter?
So much so that I am now bigger than the Baron.
Would you believe it, monsieur?
Parbleu. It seems to me that is quite evident.
Do you see, stupid? Said Porthos, that is quite evident.
Be still, my dear Porthos, resumed D'Artagnan, becoming slightly impatient. I don't understand why your clothes should not fit you, because Mustin has grown stouter.
I am going to explain it, said Porthos. You remember having related to me the story of the Roman general Antony, who had always 7 wild boars kept roasting, each cooked up to a different point, so that he might be able to have his dinner at any time of the day he chose to ask for it. Well, then, I resolved, as at any time I might be invited to court to spend a week, I resolved to have always 7 suits ready for the occasion.
Capitally reasoned, Porthos, only a man must have a fortune like yours to gratify such whims. Without counting the time lost in being measured, the fashions are always changing.
That is exactly the point, said Porthos, in regard to which I flattered myself I had hit on a very ingenious device.
Tell me what it is, for I don't doubt your genius.
You remember what Mustin once was, then?
Yes, when he used to call himself Mousqueton.
And you remember, too, the period when he began to grow fatter?
No, not exactly. I beg your pardon, my good Mustin.
Oh! You are not in fault, monsieur, said Mustin, graciously. You were in Paris, and as for us, we were at Pierrefonds.
Well, well, my dear Porthos, there was a time when Mustin began to grow fat. Is that what you wish to say?
Yes, my friend, and I greatly rejoice over the period.
Indeed, I believe you do, exclaimed D'Artagnan.
You understand, continued Porthos, what a world of trouble it spared for me.
No, I don't by any means.
Look here, my friend. In the first place, as you have said, to be measured is a loss of time, even though it occur only once a fortnight. And then, one may be traveling, and then you wish to have 7 suits always with you. In short, I have a horror of letting anyone take my measure.
Confound it. Either one is a nobleman or not. To be scrutinized and scanned by a fellow who completely analyzes you, by inch and line, 'tis degrading. Here, they find you too hollow, there, too prominent. They recognize your strong and weak points.
See, now, when we leave the measurer's hands, we are like those strongholds whose angles and different thicknesses have been ascertained by a spy.
In truth, my dear Porthos, you possess ideas entirely original.
Ah! You see, when a man is an engineer and has fortified Belle Isle, 'tis natural, my friend.
Well, I had an idea, which would doubtless have proved a good one, but for Mustin's carelessness.
D'Artagnan glanced at Mustin, who replied by a slight movement of his body, as if to say, you will see whether I am at all to blame in all this.
I congratulated myself, then, resumed Porthos, at seeing Mustin get fat, and I did all I could, by means of substantial feeding, to make him stout always in the hope that he would come to equal myself in girth, and could then be measured in my stead.
Ah! Cried D'Artagnan. I see that spared you both time and humiliation.
Consider my joy when, after a year and a half's judicious feeding, for I used to feed him up myself the fellow.
Oh! I lent a good hand myself, monsieur, said Mustin, humbly.
That's true. Consider my joy when, one morning, I perceived Mustin was obliged to squeeze in, as I once did myself, to get through the little secret door that those fools of architects had made in the chamber of the late Madame du Vallon, in the Chateau of Pierrefonds. And, by the way, about that door, my friend, I should like to ask you, who know everything, why these wretches of architects, who ought to have the compasses run into them, just to remind them,
came to make doorways through which nobody but thin people can pass.
Oh, those doors, answered D'Artagnan, were meant for gallants, and they have generally slight and slender figures.
Madame du Vallon had no gallant, answered Porthos, majestically.
Perfectly true, my friend, resumed D'Artagnan, but the architects were probably making their calculations on a basis of the probability of your marrying again.
Ah! That is possible, said Porthos. And now I have received an explanation of how it is that doorways are made too narrow, let us return to the subject of Mustan's fatness. But see how the two things apply to each other. I have always noticed that people's ideas run parallel. And so, observe this phenomenon, D'Artagnan. I was talking to you of Mustan, who is fat, and it led us on to Madame du Vallon, who is thin.
Hum. Is it not marvelous?
My dear friend, a savant of my acquaintance, M. Kostauer, has made the same observation as you have, and he calls the process by some Greek name which I forget.
What? My remark is not then original? Cried Porthos, astounded. I thought I was the discoverer.
My friend, the fact was known before Aristotle's days, that is to say, nearly 2,000 years ago.
Well, well, 'tis no less true, said Porthos, delighted at the idea of having jumped to a conclusion so closely in agreement with the greatest sages of antiquity.
Wonderfully, but suppose we return to Mustan. It seems to me, we have left him fattening under our very eyes.
Yes, monsieur, said Mustan.
Well, said Porthos, Mustan fattened so well, that he gratified all my hopes, by reaching my standard, a fact of which I was well able to convince myself, by seeing the rascal, one day, in a waistcoat of mine, which he had turned into a coat-a waistcoat, the mere embroidery of which was worth 100 pistoles.
'Twas only to try it on, monsieur, said Mustan.
From that moment I determined to put Mustan in communication with my tailors, and to have him measured instead of myself.
A capital idea, Porthos, but Mustan is a foot and a half shorter than you.
Exactly. They measured him down to the ground, and the end of the skirt came just below my knee.
What a marvelous man you are, Porthos. Such a thing could happen only to you.
Ah. Yes, pay your compliments, you have ample grounds to go upon. It was exactly at that time, that is to say, nearly 2 years and a half ago, that I set out for Belle Isle, instructing Mustan, so as always to have, in every event, a pattern of every fashion, to have a coat made for himself every month.
And did Mustan neglect complying with your instructions?
Ah! That was anything but right, Mustan.
No, monsieur, quite the contrary, quite the contrary.
No, he never forgot to have his coats made, but he forgot to inform me that he had got stouter.
But it was not my fault, monsieur. Your tailor never told me.
And this to such an extent, monsieur, continued Porthos, that the fellow in 2 years has gained 18 inches in girth, and so my last dozen coats are all too large, from a foot to a foot and a half.
But the rest, those which were made when you were of the same size?
They are no longer the fashion, my dear friend. Were I to put them on, I should look like a fresh arrival from Siam, and as though I had been 2 years away from court.
I understand your difficulty. You have how many new suits?
9?
36?
And yet not one to wear.
Well, you must have a 37th made, and give the 36th to Mustan.
Ah! Monsieur! Said Mustan, with a gratified air.
The truth is, that monsieur has always been very generous to me.
Do you mean to insinuate that I hadn't that idea, or that I was deterred by the expense?
But it wants only 2 days to the fate, I received the invitation yesterday, made Mustan post hither with my wardrobe, and only this morning discovered my misfortune, and from now till the day after tomorrow, there isn't a single fashionable tailor who will undertake to make me a suit.
That is to say, one covered all over with gold, isn't it?
I wish it so.
Undoubtedly, all over.
Oh, we shall manage it. You won't leave for 3 days. The invitations are for Wednesday, and this is only Sunday morning.
'Tis true, but Aramis has strongly advised me to be at Vaux 24 hours beforehand.
How, Aramis?
Yes, it was Aramis who brought me the invitation.
Ah! To be sure, I see. You are invited on the part of M. Fouquet?
By no means. By the king, dear friend. The letter bears the following as large as life, M. Le Baron du Vallon is informed that the king has condescended to place him on the invitation list.
Very good, but you leave with M. Fouquet?
And when I think, cried Porthos, stamping on the floor, when I think I shall have no clothes, I am ready to burst with rage. I should like to strangle somebody or smash something.
Neither strangle anybody nor smash anything, Porthos, I will manage it all. Put on one of your 36 suits, and come with me to a tailor.
Pooh. My agent has seen them all this morning.
Even M. Percerin?
Who is M. Percerin?
Oh. Only the king's tailor.
Oh, ah, yes, said Porthos, who wished to appear to know the king's tailor, but now heard his name mentioned for the first time, to M.
Percerin's, by Jove. I was afraid he would be too busy.
Doubtless he will be, but be at ease, Porthos, he will do for me what he wouldn't do for another. Only you must allow yourself to be measured.
Ah! Said Porthos, with a sigh, 'tis vexatious, but what would you have me do?
Do? As others do, as the king does.
What? Do they measure the king, too? Does he put up with it?
The king is a beau, my good friend, and so are you, too, whatever you may say about it.
Porthos smiled triumphantly. Let us go to the king's tailor, he said, and since he measures the king, I think, by my faith, I may do worse than allow him to measure me.
Chapter 3. Who Monsieur Jean Percerin was.
The king's tailor, Monsieur Jean Percerin, occupied a rather large house in the Rue Saint-Honoré, near the Rue de l'Arbre Sec. He was a man of great taste in elegant stuffs, embroideries, and velvets, being hereditary tailor to the king. The preferment of his house reached as far back as the time of Charles IX, from whose reign dated, as we know, fancy and bravery difficult enough to gratify. The Percerin of that period was a Huguenot, like Ambrose Pare, and had been spared by the Queen of Navarre, the beautiful Margot, as they used to write and say, too, in those days, because, in sooth, he was the only one who could make for her those wonderful riding habits which she so loved to wear, seeing that they were marvelously well suited to hide certain anatomical defects, which the Queen of Navarre used very studiously to conceal. Percerin being saved, made, out of gratitude, some beautiful black bodices, very inexpensively indeed, for Queen Catherine, who ended by being pleased at the preservation of a Huguenot people, on whom she had long looked with detestation. But Percerin was a very prudent man, and having heard it said that there was no more dangerous sign for a Protestant than to be smiled up on by Catherine, and having observed that her smiles were more frequent than usual, he speedily turned Catholic with all his family, and having thus become irreproachable, attained the lofty position of Master Tailor to the Crown of France. Under Henry III, gay king as he was, this position was as grand as the height of one of the loftiest peaks of the Cordilleras. Now Percerin had been a clever man all his life, and by way of keeping up his reputation beyond the grave, took very good care not to make a bad death of it, and so contrived to die very skillfully, and that at the very moment he felt his powers of invention declining. He left a son and a daughter, both worthy of the name they were called upon to bear, the son, a cutter as unerring and exact as the square rule, the daughter, apt at embroidery, and at designing ornaments. The marriage of Henry IV, and Marie de Medici, and the exquisite court mourning for the aforementioned queen, together with a few words let fall by M. de Bassompierre, king of the beaux of the period, made the fortune of the second generation of Percerins. M. Consino Consini, and his wife Galagai, who subsequently shone at the French court, sought to Italianize the fashion, and introduce some Florentine tailors, but Percerin, touched to the quick in his patriotism and his self-esteem, entirely defeated these foreigners, and that so well that Consino was the first to give up his compatriots, and held the French tailor in such esteem that he would never employ any other, and thus wore a doublet of his on the very day that Vitry blew out his brains with a pistol at the Pont du Louvre. And so it was a doublet issuing from M. Percerin's workshop, which the Parisians rejoiced in hacking into so many pieces with the living human body it contained. Notwithstanding the favor Consino Consini had shown Percerin, the king, Louis XIII, had the generosity to bear no malice to his tailor, and to retain him in his service. At the time that Louis XIII just afforded this great example of equity, Percerin had brought up two sons, one of whom made his debut at the marriage of Anne of Austria, invented that admirable Spanish costume, in which Richelieu danced a saraband, made the costumes for the tragedy of Mirame, and stitched onto Buckingham's mantle those famous pearls which were destined to be scattered about the pavements of the Louvre. A man becomes easily notable who has made the dresses of a Duke of Buckingham, I.M. de Cinq-Mars, a Mademoiselle Ninon, I.M. de Beaufort, and a Marion de Lorme. And thus Percerin III had attained the summit of his glory when his father died. This same Percerin III, old, famous and wealthy, yet further dressed Louis XIV, and having no son, which was a great cause of sorrow to him, seeing that with himself his dynasty would end, he had brought up several hopeful pupils. He possessed a carriage, a country house,
men servants the tallest in Paris, and by special authority from Louis XIV, a pack of hounds. He worked for M.M. de Lyon and Letellier, under a sort of patronage, but politic man as he was, and versed in state secrets, he never succeeded in fitting M. Colbert. This is beyond explanation, it is a matter for guessing or for intuition. Great geniuses of every kind live on unseen, intangible ideas, they act without themselves knowing why. The great Percerin, for, contrary to the rule of dynasties, it was, above all, the last of the Percerins who deserved the name of great. The great Percerin was inspired when he cut a robe for the queen, or a coat for the king, he could mount a mantle for monsieur, the clock of a stocking for madame, but, in spite of his supreme talent, he could never hit off anything approaching a creditable fit for M. Colbert. That man, he used often to say, is beyond my art, my needle can never dot him down. We need scarcely say that Percerin was M. Fouquet's tailor, and that the superintendent highly esteemed him. M. Percerin was nearly 80 years old, nevertheless still fresh, and at the same time so dry, the courtiers used to say, that he was positively brittle. His renown and his fortune were great enough for M. Le Prince, that king of fops, to take his arm when talking over the fashions, and for those least eager to pay never to dare to leave their accounts in arrear with him, for Master Percerin would for the first time make clothes upon credit, but the second never, unless paid for the former order. It is easy to see at once that a tailor of such renown, instead of running after customers, made difficulties about obliging any fresh ones. And so Percerin declined to fit bourgeois, or those who had but recently obtained patents of nobility. A story used to circulate that even M. de Mazarin, in exchange for Percerin supplying him with a full suit of ceremonial vestments as cardinal, one fine day slipped letters of nobility into his pocket. It was to the house of this grand llama of tailors that D'Artagnan took the despairing Porthos, who, as they were going along, said to his friend, "Take care, my good D'Artagnan, not to compromise the dignity of a man such as I am with the arrogance of this Percerin, who will, I expect, be very impertinent, for I give you notice, my friend, that if he is wanting in respect I will infallibly chastise him." "Presented by me," replied D'Artagnan, "you have nothing to fear, even though you are what you are not." "Ah! 'Tis because." "What? Have you anything against Percerin, Porthos?" "I think that I once sent mustard to a fellow of that name."
"And then?"
"The fellow refused to supply me."
"Oh, a misunderstanding, no doubt, which it will be now exceedingly easy to set right. Mustard must have made a mistake."
"Perhaps."
"He has confused the names."
"Possibly. That rascal Mustard never can remember names."
"I will take it all upon myself."
"Very good. Stop the carriage, Porthos, here we are."
"Here? How here?"
"We are at the Halles, and you told me the house was at the corner of the Rue de l'Arbre Sec."
"'Tis true, but look."
"Well, I do look, and I see."
"What?"
"Pardieu. That we are at the Halles."
"You do not, I suppose, want our horses to clamber up on the roof of the carriage in front of us?"
"No."
"Nor the carriage in front of us to mount on top of the one in front of it. Nor that the second should be driven over the roofs of the 30 or 40 others which have arrived before us."
"No, you are right, indeed. What a number of people! And what are they all about?"
"'Tis very simple. They are waiting their turn."
"Bah! Have the comedians of the Hotel de Bourgogne shifted their quarters?"
"No, their turn to obtain an entrance to M. Percerin's house."
"And we are going to wait too?"
"Oh, we shall show ourselves prompter and not so proud."
"What are we to do, then?"
"Get down, pass through the footmen and lackeys, and enter the tailor's house, which I will answer for our doing, if you go first."
"Come along, then," said Porthos.
They accordingly alighted and made their way on foot towards the establishment. The cause of the confusion was that M. Percerin's doors were closed, while a servant, standing before them, was explaining to the illustrious customers of the illustrious tailor that just then M. Percerin could not receive anybody. It was bruited about outside still, on the authority of what the great lackey had told some great noble whom he favored, in confidence, that M. Percerin was engaged on 5 costumes for the king, and that, owing to the urgency of the case, he was meditating in his office on the ornaments, colors, and cut of these 5 suits. Some, contented with this reason, went away again, contented to repeat the tale to others, but others, more tenacious, insisted on having the doors opened, and among these last 3 blue ribbons, intended to take parts in a ballet, which would inevitably fail unless the said 3 had their costumes shaped by the very hand of the great Percerin himself. D'Artagnan,
pushing on Porthos, who scattered the groups of people right and left, succeeded in gaining the counter, behind which the journeyman tailors were doing their best to answer queries. We forgot to mention that at the door they wanted to put off Porthos like the rest, but D'Artagnan, showing himself, pronounced merely these words, "The king's order," and was let in with his friend. The poor fellows had enough to do, and did their best, to reply to the demands of the customers in the absence of their master, leaving off drawing a stitch to knit a sentence, and when wounded pride, or disappointed expectation, brought down upon them too cutting a rebuke, he who was attacked made a dive and disappeared under the counter. The line of discontented lords formed a truly remarkable picture. Our captain of musketeers, a man of sure and rapid observation, took it all in at a glance, and having run over the groups, his eye rested on a man in front of him. This man, seated upon a stool, scarcely showed his head above the counter that sheltered him. He was about 40 years of age, with a melancholy aspect, pale face, and soft luminous eyes. He was looking at D'Artagnan and the rest, with his chin resting upon his hand, like a common inquiring amateur. Only on perceiving, and doubtless recognizing, our captain, he pulled his hat down over his eyes. It was this action, perhaps, that attracted D'Artagnan's attention. If so, the gentleman who had pulled down his hat produced an effect entirely different from what he had desired. In other respects his costume was plain, and his hair evenly cut enough for customers, who were not close observers, to take him for a mere tailor's apprentice, perched behind the board, and carefully stitching cloth or velvet. Nevertheless, this man held up his head too often to be very productively employed with his fingers. D'Artagnan was not deceived, not he, and he saw at once that if this man was working at anything, it certainly was not at velvet. "Eh," said he, addressing this man, "and so you have become a tailor's boy, Monsieur Moliere." "Hush, M. D'Artagnan," replied the man, softly, "you will make them recognize me." "Well, and what harm?" "The fact is, there is no harm, but—" "You were going to say there is no good in doing it either, is it not so?" "Alas! No, for I was occupied in examining some excellent figures." go on, Monsieur Moliere. I quite understand the interest you take in the plates. I will not disturb your studies."
"Thank you.
But on one condition, that you tell me where M. Percerin really is."
"Oh. Willingly, in his own room. Only—"
"Only that one can't enter it?"
"Unapproachable."
"For everybody?"
"Everybody. He brought me here so that I might be at my ease to make my observations, and then he went away."
"Well, my dear Monsieur Moliere, but you will go and tell him I am here."
"I!" exclaimed Moliere, in the tone of a courageous dog, from which you snatch the bone it has legitimately gained, "I disturbed myself. Ah! Monsieur D'Artagnan, how hard you are upon me!
If you don't go directly and tell M. Percerin that I am here, my dear Moliere," said D'Artagnan, in a low tone, "I warn you of one thing, that I won't exhibit to you the friend I have brought with me." Moliere indicated Porthos by an imperceptible gesture. "This gentleman, is it not?"
"Yes."
Moliere fixed upon Porthos one of those looks which penetrate the minds and hearts of men. The subject doubtless appeared a very promising one, for he immediately rose and led the way into the adjoining chamber. Chapter 4. The Patterns. During all this time the noble mob was slowly heaving away, leaving at every angle of the counter either a murmur or a menace, as the waves leave foam or scattered seaweed on the sands, when they retire with the ebbing tide. In about 10 minutes Moliere reappeared, making another sign to D'Artagnan from under the hangings. The latter hurried after him, with Porthos in the rear, and after threading a labyrinth of corridors, introduced him to M. Percerin's room. The old man, with his sleeves turned up, was gathering up in folds a piece of gold-flowered brocade, so as the better to exhibit its luster. Perceiving D'Artagnan, he put the silk aside, and came to meet him, by no means radiant with joy, and by no means courteous, but, take it altogether, in a tolerably civil manner. "The captain of the king's musketeers will excuse me, I am sure, for I am engaged."
"Eh?
Yes, on the king's costumes, I know that, my dear Monsieur Percerin. You are making 3, they tell me."
"5, my dear sir, 5.
3 or 5, tis all the same to me, my dear monsieur, and I know that you will make them most exquisitely."
"Yes, I know. Once made they will be the most beautiful in the world, I do not deny it, but that they may be the most beautiful in the world, they must first be made, and to do this, captain, I am pressed for time."
"Oh, bah! There are 2 days yet, tis much more than you require, Monsieur Percerin," said D'Artagnan,
in the coolest possible manner.
Perserin raised his head with the air of a man little accustomed to be contradicted, even in his whims, but D'Artagnan did not pay the least attention to the airs which the illustrious tailor began to assume.
"My dear M. Perserin," he continued, "I bring you a customer."
"Ah! Ah!" exclaimed Perserin, crossly.
"M. le Baron du Vallon de Bracieux de Pierrefonds," continued D'Artagnan.
Perserin attempted a bow, which found no favor in the eyes of the terrible Porthos, who, from his first entry into the room, had been regarding the tailor askance.
"A very good friend of mine," concluded D'Artagnan.
"I will attend to monsieur," said Perserin, "but later."
"Later? But when?"
"When I have time."
"You have already told my valet as much," broke in Porthos, discontentedly.
"Very likely," said Perserin, "I am nearly always pushed for time."
"My friend," returned Porthos, sententiously, "there is always time to be found when one chooses to seek it."
Perserin turned crimson, an ominous sign indeed in old men blanched by age.
"Monsieur is quite at liberty to confer his custom elsewhere."
"Come, come, Perserin," interposed D'Artagnan, "you are not in a good temper today.
Well, I will say one more word to you, which will bring you on your knees. Monsieur is not only a friend of mine, but more, a friend of M. Fouquet's."
"Ah, ah," exclaimed the tailor, "that is another thing." Then turning to Porthos, "Monsieur le Baron is attached to the superintendent?" he inquired.
"I am attached to myself," shouted Porthos, at the very moment that the tapestry was raised to introduce a new speaker in the dialogue.
Molière was all observation, D'Artagnan laughed, Porthos swore.
"My dear Perserin," said D'Artagnan, "you will make a dress for the Baron. Tis I who ask you.
To you I will not say nay, Captain.
But that is not all, you will make it for him at once.
Tis impossible within 8 days."
"That, then, is as much as to refuse, because the dress is wanted for the fete at Vaux."
"I repeat that it is impossible," returned the obstinate old man.
"By no means, dear Monsieur Perserin, above all if I ask you," said a mild voice at the door, a silvery voice which made D'Artagnan prick up his ears. It was the voice of Aramis.
"Monsieur d'Herblay!" cried the tailor.
"Aramis," murmured D'Artagnan.
"Ah! Our bishop!" said Porthos.
"Good morning, D'Artagnan, good morning, Porthos, good morning, my dear friends," said Aramis.
"Come, come, M. Perserin, make the Baron's dress, and I will answer for it you will gratify M. Fouquet." And he accompanied the words with a sign, which seemed to say, "Agree," and dismiss them.
It appeared that Aramis had overmastered Perserin in influence superior even to D'Artagnan's, for the tailor bowed in assent, and turning round upon Porthos, said, "Go and get measured on the other side." Porthos colored in a formidable manner. D'Artagnan saw the storm coming, and addressing Molière, said to him, in an undertone, "You see before you, my dear monsieur, a man who considers himself disgraced. If you measure the flesh and bones that heaven has given him, study this type for me, Master Aristophanes, and profit by it."
Molière had no need of encouragement, and his gaze dwelt long and keenly on the Baron Porthos.
"Monsieur," he said, "if you will come with me, I will make them take your measure without touching you."
"Oh," said Porthos, "how do you make that out, my friend?"
"I say that they shall apply neither line nor rule to the seams of your dress. It is a new method we have invented for measuring people of quality, who are too sensitive to allow low-born fellows to touch them. We know some susceptible persons who will not put up with being measured, a process which, as I think, wounds the natural dignity of a man, and if perchance monsieur should be one of these."
"Corbouf! I believe I am too."
"Well, that is a capital and most consolatory coincidence, and you shall have the benefit of our invention."
"But how in the world can it be done?" asked Porthos, delighted.
"Monsieur," said Molière, bowing, "if you will deign to follow me, you will see."
Aramis observed this scene with all his eyes. Perhaps he fancied from D'Artagnan's liveliness that he would leave with Porthos, so as not to lose the conclusion of a scene well begun. But, clear-sighted as he was, Aramis deceived himself. Porthos and Molière left together, D'Artagnan remained with Perserin.
Why?
From curiosity, doubtless, probably to enjoy a little longer the society of his good friend Aramis. As Molière and Porthos disappeared, D'Artagnan drew near the Bishop of Vannes, a proceeding which appeared particularly to disconcert him.
"A dress for you, also, is it not, my friend?"
Aramis smiled.
"No," said he.
"You will go to Vaux, however?"
I shall go, but without a new dress. You forget, dear D'Artagnan, that a poor bishop of Vannes is not rich enough to have new dresses for every fête.
Bah! Said the musketeer, laughing, and do we write no more poems now, either?
Oh! D'Artagnan, exclaimed Aramis, I have long ago given up all such tomfoolery.
True, repeated D'Artagnan, only half convinced. As for Perserin, he was once more absorbed in contemplation of the brocades.
Don't you perceive, said Aramis, smiling, that we are greatly boring this good gentleman, my dear D'Artagnan?
Ah! Ah! Murmured the musketeer, aside, that is, I am boring you, my friend. Then aloud, well, then, let us leave, I have no further business here, and if you are as disengaged as I, Aramis.
No, not I wished.
Ah! You had something particular to say to M. Perserin? Why did you not tell me so at once?
Something particular, certainly, repeated Aramis, but not for you, D'Artagnan. But, at the same time, I hope you will believe that I can never have anything so particular to say that a friend like you may not hear it.
Oh, no, no. I am going, said D'Artagnan, imparting to his voice an evident tone of curiosity, for Aramis's annoyance, well dissembled as it was, had not a whit escaped him, and he knew that, in that impenetrable mind, everything, even the most apparently trivial, was designed to some end, an unknown one, but an end that, from the knowledge he had of his friend's character, the musketeer felt must be important. On his part, Aramis saw that D'Artagnan was not without suspicion, and pressed him.
Stay, by all means, he said, this is what it is. Then turning towards the tailor, my dear Perserin, said he, I am even very happy that you are here, D'Artagnan.
Oh, indeed, exclaimed the Gascon, for the third time, even less deceived this time than before.
Perserin never moved. Aramis roused him violently, by snatching from his hands the stuff upon which he was engaged.
My dear Perserin, said he, I have, near hand, M. Lebrun, one of M. Fouquet's painters.
Ah, very good, thought D'Artagnan, but why Lebrun?
Aramis looked at D'Artagnan, who seemed to be occupied with an engraving of Mark Antony.
And you wish that I should make him a dress, similar to those of the Epicureans? Answered Perserin. And while saying this, in an absent manner, the worthy tailor endeavored to recapture his piece of brocade.
An Epicurean's dress? Asked D'Artagnan, in a tone of inquiry.
I see, said Aramis, with a most engaging smile, it is written that our dear D'Artagnan shall know all our secrets this evening.
Yes, friend, you have surely heard speak of M. Fouquet's Epicureans, have you not?
Undoubtedly. Is it not a kind of poetical society, of which La Fontaine, Laurent, Palissin, and Molière are members, and which holds its sittings at Saint-Mandé?
Exactly so. Well, we are going to put our poets in uniform, and enroll them in a regiment for the king.
Oh, very well, I understand, a surprise M. Fouquet is getting up for the king.
Be at ease, if that is the secret about M. Lebrun, I will not mention it.
Always agreeable, my friend.
No, Monsieur Lebrun has nothing to do with this part of it, the secret which concerns him is far more important than the other.
Then, if it is so important as all that, I prefer not to know it, said D'Artagnan, making a show of departure.
Come in, M. Lebrun, come in, said Aramis, opening a side door with his right hand, and holding back D'Artagnan with his left.
I faith, I too, am quite in the dark, quoth Perserin.
Aramis took an opportunity, as is said in theatrical matters.
My dear M. de Perserin, Aramis continued, you are making 5 dresses for the king, are you not?
One in brocade, one in hunting cloth, one in velvet, one in satin, and one in Florentine stuffs.
Yes, but how do you know all that, Monsignor? Said Perserin, astounded.
It is all very simple, my dear monsieur, there will be a hunt, a banquet, concert, promenade and reception, these 5 kinds of dress are required by etiquette.
You know everything, Monsignor.
And a thing or two in addition, muttered D'Artagnan.
But, cried the tailor, in triumph, what you do not know, Monsignor Prince of the Church though you are what nobody will know what only the king, Mademoiselle de La Valliere, and myself do know, is the color of the materials and nature of the ornaments, and the cut, the ensemble, the finish of it all.
Well, said Aramis, that is precisely what I have come to ask you, dear Perserin.
Ah, bah! Exclaimed the tailor, terrified, though Aramis had pronounced these words in his softest and most honeyed tones.
The request appeared, on reflection, so exaggerated, so ridiculous, so monstrous to M. Purserin that first he laughed to himself, then aloud, and finished with a shout. D'Artagnan followed his example, not because he found the matter so very funny, but in order not to allow Aramis to cool. "At the outset, I appear to be hazarding an absurd question, do I not?" said Aramis. "But D'Artagnan, who is incarnate wisdom itself, will tell you that I could not do otherwise than ask you this." "Let us see," said the attentive musketeer, perceiving with his wonderful instinct that they had only been skirmishing till now, and that the hour of battle was approaching. "Let us see," said Purserin, incredulously. "Why, now," continued Aramis, "does M. Fouquet give the king a fate? Is it not to please him?"
"Assuredly," said Purserin.
D'Artagnan nodded assent. "By delicate attentions? By some happy device? By a succession of surprises, like that of which we were talking? The enrollment of our Epicureans."
"Admirable.
Well, then, this is the surprise we intend. M. Lebrun here is a man who draws most excellently."
"Yes," said Purserin, "I have seen his pictures, and observed that his dresses were highly elaborated. That is why I at once agreed to make him a costume whether to agree with those of the Epicureans, or an original one."
"My dear monsieur, we accept your offer, and shall presently avail ourselves of it, but just now, M. Lebrun is not in one of the dresses you will make for himself, but of those you are making for the king." Purserin made a bound backwards, which D'Artagnan, calmest and most appreciative of men, did not consider overdone, so many strange and startling aspects wore the proposal which Aramis had just hazarded. The king's dresses. Give the king's dresses to any mortal whatever.
"Oh! For once, Monseigneur, your grace is mad!" cried the poor tailor in extremity.
"Help me now, D'Artagnan," said Aramis, more and more calm and smiling. "Help me now to persuade monsieur, for you understand, do you not?"
Eh.
"Not exactly, I declare."
"What? You do not understand that M. Fouquet wishes to afford the king the surprise of finding his portrait on his arrival at Vaux, and that the portrait, which be a striking resemblance, ought to be dressed exactly as the king will be on the day it is shown."
"Oh! Yes, said the musketeer, nearly convinced, so plausible was this reasoning. "Yes, my dear Aramis, you are right, it is a happy idea. I will wager it is one of your own, Aramis."
"Well, I don't know," replied the bishop, "either mine or M. Fouquet's." Then scanning Purserin, after noticing D'Artagnan's hesitation, "Well, Monsieur Purserin," he asked, "what do you say to this?"
"I say, that you are, doubtless, free to refuse. I know well and I by no means count upon compelling you, my dear monsieur. I will say more, I even understand all the delicacy you feel in taking up with M. Fouquet's idea. You dread appearing to flatter the king. A noble spirit, M. Purserin, a noble spirit." The tailor stammered.
"It would, indeed, be a very pretty compliment to pay the young prince," continued Aramis, "but as the sure intendant told me, if Purserin refuse, tell him that it will not at all lower him in my opinion, and I shall always esteem him, only."
"Only?" repeated Purserin, rather troubled.
"Only," continued Aramis, "I shall be compelled to say to the king, you understand, my dear Monsieur Purserin, that these are M. Fouquet's words. I shall be constrained to say to the king, 'Sire, I had intended to present your majesty with your portrait, but owing to a feeling of delicacy, slightly exaggerated perhaps, although creditable, M. Purserin opposed the project.'"
"Opposed?" cried the tailor, terrified at the responsibility which would weigh upon him, "I to oppose the desire, the will of M. Fouquet when he is seeking to please the king. Oh, what a hateful word you have uttered, Monseigneur. Oppose? Oh, 'tis not I who said it, heaven have mercy on me. I call the captain of the musketeers to witness it. Is it not true, Monsieur D'Artagnan, that I have opposed nothing?"
D'Artagnan made a sign indicating that he wished to remain neutral. He felt that there was an intrigue at the bottom of it, whether comedy or tragedy, he was at his wit's end at not being able to fathom it, but in the meanwhile wished to keep clear. But already Purserin, goaded by the idea that the king was to be told he stood in the way of a pleasant surprise, had offered Lebrun a chair, and proceeded to bring from a wardrobe 4 magnificent dresses, the 5th being still in the workman's hands, and these masterpieces he successively fitted upon 4 lay figures, which, imported into France in the time of Concini, had been given to Purserin too. By Marshal d'Onore, after the discomfiture of the Italian tailors ruined in their competition. The painter set to work to draw and then to paint the dresses. But Aramis,
who was closely watching all the phases of his toil, suddenly stopped him.
"I think you have not quite got it, my dear Lebrun," he said. "Your colors will deceive you, and on canvas we shall lack that exact resemblance which is absolutely requisite. Time is necessary for attentively observing the finer shades."
"Quite true," said Perserin, "but time is wanting, and on that head, you'll agree with me, Monseigneur, I can do nothing."
"Then the affair will fail," said Aramis, quietly, "and that because of a want of precision in the colors."
Nevertheless, Lebrun went on copying the materials and ornaments with the closest fidelity, a process which Aramis watched with ill-concealed impatience.
"What in the world, now, is the meaning of this imbroglio?" the musketeer kept saying to himself.
"That will never do," said Aramis. "M. Lebrun, close your box, and roll up your canvas."
"But, monsieur," cried the vexed painter, "the light is abominable here."
"An idea, M. Lebrun, an idea. If we had a pattern of the materials, for example, and with time, and a better light."
"Oh, then," cried Lebrun, "I would answer for the effect."
"Good," said D'Artagnan, "this ought to be the knotty point of the whole thing. They want a pattern of each of the materials. Mordieu! Will this Perserin give in now?"
Perserin, beaten from his last retreat, and duped, moreover, by the feigned good nature of Aramis, cut out 5 patterns and handed them to the Bishop of Vannes.
"I like this better. That is your opinion, is it not?" said Aramis to D'Artagnan.
"My dear Aramis," said D'Artagnan, "my opinion is that you are always the same."
"And, consequently, always your friend," said the bishop in a charming tone.
"Yes, yes," said D'Artagnan, aloud, then, in a low voice, "if I am your dupe, double Jesuit that you are, I will not be your accomplice, and to prevent it, 'tis time I left this place. Adieu, Aramis," he added aloud, "adieu, I am going to rejoin Porthos."
"Then wait for me," said Aramis, pocketing the patterns, "for I have done, and shall be glad to say a parting word to our dear old friend."
Lebrun packed up his paints and brushes, Perserin put back the dresses into the closet, Aramis put his hand on his pocket to assure himself the patterns were secure, and they all left the study.
Chapter 5. Where, probably, Molière obtained his first idea of the bourgeois gentilhomme. D'Artagnan found Porthos in the adjoining chamber, but no longer an irritated Porthos, or a disappointed Porthos, but Porthos radiant, blooming, fascinating, and chattering with Molière, who was looking upon him with a species of idolatry, and as a man would who had not only never seen anything greater, but not even ever anything so great. Aramis went straight up to Porthos and offered him his white hand, which lost itself in the gigantic clasp of his old friend, an operation which Aramis never hazarded without a certain uneasiness. But the friendly pressure having been performed not too painfully for him, the Bishop of Vannes passed over to Molière.
"Well, monsieur," said he, "will you come with me to Saint-Mandé?"
"I will go anywhere you like, monseigneur," answered Molière.
"To Saint-Mandé!" cried Porthos, surprised at seeing the proud Bishop of Vannes fraternizing with a journeyman tailor.
"What, Aramis, are you going to take this gentleman to Saint-Mandé?"
"Yes," said Aramis, smiling, "our work is pressing."
"And besides, my dear Porthos," continued D'Artagnan, "M. Molière is not altogether what he seems."
"In what way?" asked Porthos.
"Why, this gentleman is one of M. Perserin's chief clerks, and is expected at Saint-Mandé to try on the dresses which M. Fouquet has ordered for the Epicureans."
"'Tis precisely so," said Molière.
"Yes, monsieur."
"Come, then, my dear M. Molière," said Aramis, "that is, if you have done with them. Du Vallon."
"We have finished," replied Porthos.
"And you are satisfied?" asked D'Artagnan.
"Completely so," replied Porthos.
Molière took his leave of Porthos with much ceremony, and grasped the hand which the captain of the musketeers furtively offered him.
"Pray, monsieur," concluded Porthos, mincingly, "above all, be exact."
"You will have your dress the day after tomorrow, monsieur le baron," answered Molière. And he left with Aramis.
Then D'Artagnan, taking Porthos's arm, "What has this tailor done for you, my dear Porthos," he asked, "that you are so pleased with him?"
"What has he done for me, my friend? Done for me?" cried Porthos, enthusiastically.
"Yes, I ask you, what has he done for you?"
"My friend, he has done that which no tailor ever yet accomplished, he has taken my measure without touching me."
"Ah, bah! Tell me how he did it."
"First, then, they went, I don't know where,
for a number of lay figures, of all heights and sizes, hoping there would be one to suit mine, but the largest that of the drum major of the Swiss Guard was 2 inches too short, and a half foot too narrow in the chest. Indeed. It is exactly as I tell you, D'Artagnan, but he is a great man, or at the very least a great tailor, is this M. Molière. He was not at all put at fault by the circumstance.
What did he do, then?
Oh. It is a very simple matter. I' faith, 'tis an unheard of thing that people should have been so stupid as not to have discovered this method from the first. What annoyance and humiliation they would have spared me. Not to mention of the costumes, my dear Porthos. Yes, 30 dresses. Well, my dear Porthos, come, tell me M. Molière's plan.
Molière? You call him so, do you?
I shall make a point of recollecting his name.
Yes, or Poquelin, if you prefer that.
No, I like Molière best. When I wish to recollect his name, I shall think of Voliera, an aviary, and as I have one at Pierrefonds.
Capital. Returned D'Artagnan. And M. Molière's plan?
'Tis this, instead of pulling me to pieces, as all these rascals do of making me bend my back, and double my joints all of them low and dishonorable practices. D'Artagnan made a sign of approbation with his head.
Monsieur, he said to me, continued Porthos, a gentleman ought to measure himself. Do me the pleasure to draw near this glass, and I drew near the glass. I must own I did not exactly understand what this good M. Molière wanted with me.
Molière.
Ah. Yes, Molière, Molière. And as the fear of being measured still possessed me, take care, said I to him, what you are going to do with me, I am very ticklish, I warn you. But he, with his soft voice, for he is a courteous fellow, we must admit, my friend, he with his soft voice, monsieur, said he, that your dress may fit you well, it must be made according to your figure. Your figure is exactly reflected in this mirror. We shall take the measure of this reflection.
In fact, said D'Artagnan, you saw yourself in the glass, but where did they find one in which you could see your whole figure?
My good friend, it is the very glass in which the king is used to look to see himself.
Yes, but the king is a foot and a half shorter than you are.
Ah. Well, I know not how that may be, it is, no doubt, a cunning way of flattering the king, but the looking-glass was too large for me. 'Tis true that its height was made up of 3 Venetian plates of glass, placed one above another, and its breadth of 3 similar parallelograms in juxtaposition.
Oh, Porthos! What excellent words you have command of! Where in the world did you acquire such a voluminous vocabulary?
At Belle Isle. Aramis and I had to use such words in our strategic studies and castramentative experiments.
D'Artagnan recoiled, as though the sesquipedalian syllables had knocked the breath out of his body.
Ah! Very good. Let us return to the looking-glass, my friend.
Then, this good M. Molière.
Molière.
Yes, Molière, you are right. You will see now, my dear friend, that I shall recollect his name quite well. This excellent M. Molière set to work tracing outlines on the mirror, with a piece of Spanish chalk, following in all the make of my arms and my shoulders, all the while expounding this maxim, which I thought admirable: it is advisable that a dress should not incommode its wearer.
In reality, said D'Artagnan, that is an excellent maxim, which is, unfortunately, seldom carried out in practice.
That is why I found it all the more astonishing, when he expatiated upon it.
Ah! He expatiated?
Parbleu! Let me hear his theory.
Seeing that, he continued, one may, in awkward circumstances, or in a troublesome position, have one's doublet on one shoulder, and not desire to take one's doublet off.
True, said D'Artagnan.
And so, continued M. Molière.
Molière.
Molière, yes. And so, went on M. Molière, you wanted to draw your sword, monsieur, and you have your doublet on your back. What do?
I take it off, I answered.
Well, no, he replied.
How no?
I say that the dress should be so well made, that it will in no way encumber you, even in drawing your sword.
Ah, ah.
Throw yourself on guard, pursued he. I did it with such wondrous firmness, that 2 panes of glass burst out of the window.
'Tis nothing, nothing, said he. Keep your position.
I raised my left arm in the air, the forearm gracefully bent, the ruffle drooping, and my wrist curved, while my right arm, half extended, securely covered my wrist with the elbow, and my breast with the wrist.
Yes, said D'Artagnan, 'tis the true guard, the academic guard.
You have said the very word, dear friend. In the meanwhile,
Voliera. Molière. Hold. I should certainly, after all, prefer to call him what did you say his other name was?
Poquelin.
I prefer to call him Poquelin.
And how will you remember this name better than the other?
You understand, he calls himself Poquelin, does he not?
Yes.
If I were to call to mind Madame Coquenard.
Good.
And change Coq into Poc, Nard into Lin, and instead of Coquenard I shall have Poquelin.
"'Tis wonderful," cried D'Artagnan, astounded.
"'Go on, my friend, I am listening to you with admiration.
This Coquelin sketched my arm on the glass.
I beg your pardon, Poquelin.
What did I say, then?
You said Coquelin.
Ah. True. This Poquelin, then, sketched my arm on the glass, but he took his time over it, he kept looking at me a good deal. The fact is, that I must have been looking particularly handsome.
Does it weary you? He asked.
A little, I replied, bending a little in my hands, but I could hold out for an hour or so longer.
No, no, I will not allow it, the willing fellows will make it a duty to support your arms, as of old, men supported those of the prophet.
Very good, I answered.
That will not be humiliating to you?
My friend, said I, there is, I think, a great difference between being supported and being measured.
The distinction is full of the soundest sense, interrupted D'Artagnan.
Then, continued Porthos, he made a sign, two lads approached, one supported my left arm, while the other, with infinite address, supported my right.
Another, my man, cried he. A third approached.
Support monsieur by the waist, said he.
The garçon complied.
So that you were at rest? Asked D'Artagnan.
Perfectly, and Poquenard drew me on the glass.
Poquelin, my friend.
Poquelin, you are right. Stay, decidedly I prefer calling him Voliera.
Yes, and that it was over, wasn't it?
During that time Voliera drew me as I appeared in the mirror.
'Twas delicate in him.
I much like the plan, it is respectful, and keeps everyone in his place.
And there it ended?
Without a soul having touched me, my friend.
Except the three garçons who supported you.
Doubtless, but I have, I think, already explained to you the difference there is between supporting and measuring.
'Tis true, answered D'Artagnan, who said afterwards to himself,
I've faith, I greatly deceive myself, or I have been the means of a good windfall to that rascal Molière, and we shall assuredly see the scene hit off to the life in some comedy or other.
Porthos smiled.
What are you laughing at? Asked D'Artagnan.
Must I confess?
Well, I was laughing over my good fortune.
Oh, that is true. I don't know a happier man than you.
But what is this last piece of luck that has befallen you?
Well, my dear fellow, congratulate me.
I desire nothing better.
It seems that I am the first who has had his measure taken in that manner.
Are you so sure of it?
Nearly so.
Certain signs of intelligence which passed between Voliera and the other garrison showed me the fact.
Well, my friend, that does not surprise me from Molière, said D'Artagnan.
Voliera, my friend.
Oh, no, no, indeed. I am very willing to leave you to go on saying Voliera, but, as for me, I shall continue to say Molière.
Well, this, I was saying, does not surprise me, coming from Molière, who is a very ingenious fellow, and inspired you with this grand idea.
It will be of great use to him by and by, I am sure.
Won't it be of use to him, indeed?
I believe you, it will, and that in the highest degree. For you see my friend Molière is of all known tailors the man who best clothes our barons, comtes, and marquises according to their measure.
On this observation, neither the application nor depth of which we shall discuss, D'Artagnan and Porthos quitted M. de Percerin's house and rejoined their carriages, wherein we will leave them, in order to look after Molière and Aramis at Saint-Mandé.
Chapter 6. The Beehive, the Bees, and the Honey.
The Bishop of Vannes, much annoyed at having met D'Artagnan at M. Percerin's, returned to Saint-Mandé in no very good humor.
Molière, on the other hand, quite delighted at having made such a capital rough sketch, and at knowing where to find his original again, whenever he should desire to convert his sketch into a picture, Molière arrived in the merriest of moods. All the first story of the left wing was occupied by the most celebrated Epicureans in Paris, and those on the freest footing in the house everyone in his compartment, like the bees in their cells, employed in producing the honey intended for that royal cake which M. Fouquet proposed to offer His Majesty Louis XIV. During the fated Vox. Pelisson, his head leaning on his hand, was engaged in drawing out the plan of the prologue to the Fauchu, a comedy in three acts, which was to be put on the stage by Poquelin de Molière, as D'Artagnan called him, or Coquelin de Voliera, as Porthos styled him. Laureate, with all the charming innocence of a gazetteer, the gazetteers of all ages have always been so artless. Laureate was composing an account of the fates at Vaux, before those fates had taken place. La Fontaine sauntered about from one to the other, a peripatetic, absent-minded, boring, unbearable dreamer, who kept buzzing and humming at everybody's elbow a thousand poetic abstractions. He so often disturbed Pelisson, that the latter, raising his head, crossly said, "At least, La Fontaine, supply me with a rhyme, since you have the run of the gardens at Parnassus." "What rhyme do you want?" asked the fabler, as Madame de Sévigné used to call him. "I want a rhyme to Lumière."
"Ornière," answered La Fontaine.
"Ah, but, my good friend, one cannot talk of wheel ruts when celebrating the delights of Vaux," said Laureate.
"Besides, it doesn't rhyme," answered Pelisson.
"What? Doesn't rhyme?" cried La Fontaine, in surprise.
"Yes, you have an abominable habit, my friend, a habit which will ever prevent your becoming a poet of the first order. You rhyme in a slovenly manner."
Oh, you think so, do you, Pelisson?"
"Yes, I do, indeed. Remember that a rhyme is never good so long as one can find a better."
"Then I will never write anything again save in prose," said La Fontaine, who had taken up Pallison's reproach in earnest.
"Ah! I often suspected I was nothing but a rascally poet."
"Yes, 'tis the very truth."
"Do not say so, your remark is too sweeping, and there is much that is good in your fables."
"And to begin," continued La Fontaine, following up his idea, "I will go and burn 100 verses I have just made."
"Where are your verses?"
"In my head."
"Well, if they are in your head you cannot burn them."
"True," said La Fontaine, "but if I do not burn them?"
"Well, what will happen if you do not burn them?"
"They will remain in my mind, and I shall never forget them."
"The deuce!" cried Laureate, "what a dangerous thing! One would go mad with it."
"The deuce! The deuce!" repeated La Fontaine, "what can I do?"
"I have discovered the way," said Molière, who had entered just at this point of the conversation.
"What way?"
"Write them first and burn them afterwards."
"How simple."
"Well, I should never have discovered that. What a mind that devil of a Molière has," said La Fontaine. Then, striking his forehead, "Oh, thou wilt never be aught but an ass, Jean La Fontaine," he added.
"What are you saying there, my friend?" broke in Molière, approaching the poet, whose aside he had heard.
"I say I shall never be aught but an ass," answered La Fontaine, with a heavy sigh and swimming eyes.
"Yes, my friend," he added, with increasing grief, "it seems that I rhyme in a slovenly manner."
"Oh, 'tis wrong to say so."
"Nay, I am a poor creature."
"Who said so?"
"Parbleu. 'Twas Pelisson, did you not, Pelisson?"
Pelisson, again absorbed in his work, took good care not to answer.
"But if Pelisson said you were so," cried Molière, "Pelisson has seriously offended you."
"Do you think so?"
"Ah! I advise you, as you are a gentleman, not to leave an insult like that unpunished."
"What?"
exclaimed La Fontaine.
"Did you ever fight?"
"Once only, with a lieutenant in the light horse."
"What wrong had he done you?"
"It seems he ran away with my wife."
Ah, said Molière, becoming slightly pale, but as, at La Fontaine's declaration, the others had turned round, Molière kept upon his lips the rallying smile which had so nearly died away, and continuing to make La Fontaine speak.
"And what was the result of the duel?"
"The result was, that on the ground my opponent disarmed me, and then made an apology, promising never again to set foot in my house."
"And you considered yourself satisfied?" said Molière.
"Not at all. On the contrary, I picked up my sword. 'I beg your pardon, monsieur,' I said, 'I have not fought you because you were my wife's friend, but because I was told I ought to fight. So, as I have never known any peace save since you made her acquaintance, do me the pleasure to continue your visits as heretofore, or morbleu. Let us set to again.' And so," continued La Fontaine, "he was compelled to resume his friendship with Madame, and I continue to be the happiest of husbands."
All burst out laughing. Molière alone passed his hand across his eyes.
Why?
Perhaps to wipe away a tear, perhaps to smother a sigh. Alas! We know that Molière was a moralist, but he was not a philosopher. "'Tis all one," he said, returning to the topic of the conversation,
Palison has insulted you.
Ah, truly. I had already forgotten it. And I am going to challenge him on your behalf.
Well, you can do so, if you think it indispensable.
I do think it indispensable, and I am going to.
Stay, exclaimed La Fontaine, I want your advice.
Upon what? This insult?
No, tell me really now whether Lumiere does not rhyme with Ornier.
I should make them rhyme.
Ah. I knew you would. And I have made 100,000 such rhymes in my time.
100,000! Cried La Fontaine. 4 times as many as La Pucelle, which M. Chaplin is meditating.
Is it also on this subject, too, that you have composed 100,000 verses?
Listen to me, you eternally absent-minded creature, said Molière.
It is certain, continued La Fontaine, that legume, for instance, rhymes with posthume.
In the plural, above all?
Yes, above all in the plural, seeing that then it rhymes not with 3 letters, but with 4, as Ornier does with Lumiere.
But give me Ornières and Lumiere in the plural, my dear Palison, said La Fontaine, clapping his hand on the shoulder of his friend, whose insult he had quite forgotten, and they will rhyme.
Hem! Coughed Palison.
Molière says so, and Molière is a judge of such things, he declares he has himself made 100,000 verses.
Come, said Molière, laughing, he is off now.
It is like rivage, which rhymes admirably with herbage. I would take my oath of it.
But said Molière.
I tell you all this, continued La Fontaine, because you are preparing a divertissement for Vox, are you not?
Yes, the Fichu.
Ah, yes, the Fichu, yes, I recollect.
Well, I was thinking a prologue would admirably suit your divertissement.
Doubtless it would suit capitally.
Ah. You are of my opinion?
So much so, that I have asked you to write this very prologue.
You asked me to write it?
Yes, you, and on your refusal begged you to ask Palison, who is engaged upon it at this moment.
Ah. That is what Palison is doing, then?
I faith, my dear Molière, you are indeed often right.
When?
When you call me absent-minded. It is a monstrous defect, I will cure myself of it, and do your prologue for you.
But inasmuch as Palison is about it.
Ah, true, miserable rascal that I am. Lord was indeed right in saying I was a poor creature.
It was not Lord who said so, my friend.
Well, then, whoever said so, 'tis the same to me.
And so your divertissement is called the Fichu?
Well, can you make Huru rhyme with Fichu?
If obliged, yes.
And even with Caprisu?
Oh, no, no.
It would be hazardous, and yet why so?
There is too great a difference in the cadences.
I was fancying, said La Fontaine, leaving Molière for Lord. I was fancying.
What were you fancying?
Said Lord, in the middle of a sentence.
Make haste.
You are writing the prologue to the Fichu, are you not?
No.
Mordieu.
It is Palison.
Ah, Palison, cried La Fontaine, going over to him. I was fancying, he continued, that the nymph of Vox.
Ah, beautiful! Cried Laurent.
The nymph of Vox.
Thank you, La Fontaine, you have just given me the 2 concluding verses of my paper.
Well, if you can rhyme so well, La Fontaine, said Palison, tell me now in what way you would begin my prologue?
I should say, for instance, oh, nymph, who after who I should place a verb in the second person singular of the present indicative, and should go on thus, this grout profound.
But the verb?
Asked Palison.
To admire the greatest king of all kings round, continued La Fontaine.
But the verb, obstinately insisted Palison.
This second person singular of the present indicative?
Well, then, quittest.
Oh, nymph, who quittest now this grot profound, to admire the greatest king of all kings round.
You would not put who quittest, would you?
Why not?
Quittest, after you who?
Ah! My dear fellow, exclaimed La Fontaine, you are a shocking pedant.
Without counting, said Molière, that the second verse, King of all kings round, is very weak, my dear La Fontaine.
Then you see clearly I am nothing but a poor creature, a shuffler, as you said.
I never said so.
Then, as Lord said.
And it was not Lord either, it was Palison.
Well, Palison was right 100 times over. But what annoys me more than anything, my dear Molière, is, that I fear we shall not have our Epicurean dresses.
You expected yours, then,
For the fate?
Yes, for the fate, and then for after the fate. My housekeeper told me that my own is rather faded.
Diable. Your housekeeper is right, rather more than faded.
Ah, you see, resumed La Fontaine, the fact is, I left it on the floor in my room, and my cat.
Well, your cat.
She made her nest upon it, which has rather changed its color.
Molière burst out laughing, Palissen and Laurette followed his example. At this juncture, the Bishop of Vannes appeared, with a roll of plans and parchments under his arm. As if the angel of death had chilled all gay and sprightly fancies, as if that wan form had scared away the graces to whom Xenocrates sacrificed, silence immediately reigned through the study, and everyone resumed his self-possession and his pen. Aramis distributed the notes of invitation, and thanked them in the name of M. Fouquet. The superintendent, he said, being kept to his room by business, could not come and see them, but begged them to send him some of the fruits of their day's work, to enable him to forget the fatigue of his labor in the night. At these words, all settled down to work. La Fontaine placed himself at a table, and set his rapid pen an endless dance across the smooth white vellum. Palissen made a fair copy of his prologue. Molière contributed 50 fresh verses, with which his visit to Perserin had inspired him. Laurette, an article on the marvelous fates he predicted, and Aramis, laden with his booty like the king of the bees, that great black drone, decked with purple and gold, re-entered his apartment, silent and busy. But before departing, remember, gentlemen, said he, we leave tomorrow evening.
In that case, I must give notice at home, said Molière.
Yes, poor Molière, said Laurette, smiling, he loves his home.
He loves, yes, replied Molière, with his sad, sweet smile. He loves, that does not mean, they loved him.
As for me, said La Fontaine, they love me at Chateau Thierry, I am very sure.
Aramis here re-entered after a brief disappearance.
Will anyone go with me? He asked.
I am going by Paris, after having passed a quarter of an hour with M. Fouquet. I offer my carriage.
Good, said Molière, I accept it. I am in a hurry.
I shall dine here, said Laurette.
M. de Gourville has promised me some crawfish.
He has promised me some whitings. Find a rhyme for that, La Fontaine.
Aramis went out laughing, as only he could laugh, and Molière followed him. They were at the bottom of the stairs, when La Fontaine opened the door, and shouted out.
He has promised us some whitings, in return for these our writings.
The shouts of laughter reached the ears of Fouquet at the moment Aramis opened the door of the study. As to Molière, he had undertaken to order the horses, while Aramis went to exchange a parting word with the superintendent.
Oh, how they are laughing there! Said Fouquet, with a sigh.
Do you not laugh, Monseigneur?
I laugh no longer now, M. Durably. The fate is approaching, money is departing.
Have I not told you that was my business?
Yes, you promised me millions.
You shall have them the day after the king's entree into Vaux.
Fouquet looked closely at Aramis, and passed the back of his icy hand across his moistened brow. Aramis perceived that the superintendent either doubted him, or felt he was powerless to obtain the money. How could Fouquet suppose that a poor bishop, ex-abbé, ex-musketeer, could find any?
What doubt me? Said Aramis.
Fouquet smiled and shook his head.
Man of little faith, added the bishop.
My dear M. Durbley, answered Fouquet, if I fall.
Well, if you fall?
I shall, at least, fall from such a height, that I shall shatter myself in falling.
Then giving himself a shake, as though to escape from himself, whence came you, said he, my friend?
From Paris, from Perserin.
And what have you been doing at Perserin's? For I suppose you attach no great importance to our poet's dresses.
No, I went to prepare a surprise.
Surprise?
Yes, which you are going to give to the king.
And will it cost much?
Oh, 100 pistoles you will give Lebrun.
A painting?
Ah, all the better.
And what is this painting to represent?
I will tell you, then at the same time, whatever you may say or think of it, I went to see the dresses for our poets.
Bah. And they will be rich and elegant?
Splendid. There will be few great monsignors with so good. People will see the difference there is between the courtiers of wealth and those of friendship.
Ever generous and grateful, dear prelate.
In your school.
Fouquet grasped his hand.
And where are you going? He said.
I am off to Paris, when you shall have given a certain letter.
For whom?
M. de Lyon.
And what do you want with Lyon?
I wish to make him sign a lettre de cachet.
lettre de cachet. Do you desire to put somebody in the Bastille?
On the contrary, to let somebody out.
And who?
A poor devil, a youth, a lad who has been Bastilled these 10 years, for 2 Latin verses he made against the Jesuits.
2 Latin verses. And, for 2 Latin verses, the miserable being has been in prison for 10 years.
Yes.
And has committed no other crime?
Beyond this, he is as innocent as you or I.
On your word?
On my honor.
And his name is?
Selden.
Yes. But it is too bad. You knew this, and you never told me.
'Twas only yesterday his mother applied to me, Monsignor.
And the woman is poor.
In the deepest misery.
Heaven, said Fouquet, sometimes bears with such injustice on earth, that I hardly wonder there are wretches who doubt of its existence.
Stay, M. Durably. And Fouquet, taking a pen, wrote a few rapid lines to his colleague Lyon.
Aramis took the letter and made ready to go.
Wait, said Fouquet. He opened his drawer, and took out 10 government notes which were there, each for 1,000 francs.
Stay, he said, set the son at liberty, and give this to the mother, but, above all, do not tell her.
What, Monsignor?
That she is 10,000 livres richer than I. She would say I am but a poor superintendent.
Go.
And I pray that God will bless those who are mindful of his poor.
So also do I pray, replied Aramis, kissing Fouquet's hand.
And he went out quickly, carrying off the letter for Lyon and the notes for Selden's mother, and taking up Molière, who was beginning to lose patience.
Chapter 7. Another Supper at the Bastille.
7 o'clock sounded from the great clock of the Bastille, that famous clock, which, like all the accessories of the state prison, the very use of which is a torture, recalled to the prisoners' minds the destination of every hour of their punishment. The timepiece of the Bastille, adorned with figures, like most of the clocks of the period, represented St. Peter in bonds. It was the supper hour of the unfortunate captives. The doors, grating on their enormous hinges, opened for the passage of the baskets and trays of provisions, the abundance and the delicacy of which, as M. de Baisemeaux has himself taught us, was regulated by the condition in life of the prisoner. We understand on this head the theories of M. de Baisemeaux, sovereign dispenser of gastronomic delicacies, head cook of the royal fortress, whose trays, full laden, were ascending the steep staircases, carrying some consolation to the prisoners in the shape of honestly filled bottles of good vintages. This same hour was that of M. the governor's supper also. He had a guest today, and the spit turned more heavily than usual. Roast partridges, flanked with quails and flanking a larded leveret, boiled fowls, hams, fried and sprinkled with white wine, cartons of Guy Pusco and La Bisca crevices, these, together with soups and hors d'oeuvres, constituted the governor's bill of fare. Baisemeaux, seated at table, was rubbing his hands and looking at the Bishop of Vannes, who, booted like a cavalier, dressed in grey and sword at side, kept talking of his hunger and testifying the liveliest impatience.
M. de Baisemeaux de Montalzin was not accustomed to the unbending movements of his greatness my lord of Vannes, and this evening Aramis, becoming sprightly, volunteered confidence on confidence. The prelate had again a little touch of the musketeer about him. The bishop just trenched on the borders only of license in his style of conversation. As for M. de Baisemeaux, with the facility of vulgar people, he gave himself up entirely upon this point of his guest's freedom.
Monsieur, said he, for indeed tonight I dare not call you Monsignor.
By no means, said Aramis, call me Monsieur, I am booted.
Do you know, Monsieur, of whom you remind me this evening?
No.
Faith, said Aramis, taking up his glass, but I hope I remind you of a capital guest.
You remind me of 2, Monsieur.
François, shut the window, the wind may annoy his greatness.
And let him go, added Aramis. The supper is completely served, and we shall eat it very well without waiters. I like exceedingly to be tête-à-tête when I am with a friend.
Baisemeaux bowed respectfully.
I like exceedingly, continued Aramis, to help myself.
Retire, François, cried Baisemeaux. I was saying that your greatness puts me in mind of 2 persons, one very illustrious, the late cardinal, the great Cardinal de La Rochelle, who wore boots like you.
Indeed, said Aramis, and the other?
The other was a certain musketeer, very handsome, very brave, very adventurous, very fortunate, who, from being abbé, turned musketeer, and from musketeer turned abbé.
Aramis condescended to smile.
From abbé, continued Baisemeaux, encouraged by Aramis's smile from abbé, bishop and from bishop.
Ah! Stay there, I beg, exclaimed Aramis.
I have just said, monsieur, that you gave me the idea of a cardinal.
Enough, dear M. Baisemeaux. As you said, I have on the boots of a cavalier, but I do not intend, for all that, to embroil myself with the church this evening.
But you have wicked intentions, nevertheless, Monseigneur.
Oh, yes, wicked, I own, as everything mundane is.
You traverse the town and the streets in disguise?
In disguise, as you say.
And you still make use of your sword?
Yes, I should think so, but only when I am compelled. Do me the pleasure to summon Francois.
Have you no wine there?
'Tis not for wine, but because it is hot here, and the window is shut.
I shut the windows at supper time so as not to hear the sounds or the arrival of couriers.
Ah, yes. You hear them when the window is open?
But too well, and that disturbs me. You understand?
Nevertheless, I am suffocated.
Francois?
Francois entered.
Open the windows, I pray you, Master Francois, said Aramis.
You will allow him, dear M. Baisemeaux?
You are at home here, answered the governor.
The window was opened.
Do you not think, said M. de Baisemeaux, that you will find yourself very lonely, now M. de La Fere has returned to his household gods at Blois? He is a very old friend, is he not?
You know it as I do, Baisemeaux, seeing that you are in the musketeers with us.
Bah! With my friends I reckon neither bottles of wine nor years.
And you are right. But I do more than love M. de La Fere, dear Baisemeaux, I venerate him.
Well, for my part, though 'tis singular, said the governor, I prefer M. d'Artagnan to him. There is a man for you, who drinks long and well. That kind of people allow you at least to penetrate their thoughts.
Baisemeaux, make me tipsy tonight, let us have a merry time of it as of old, and if I have a trouble at the bottom of my heart, I promise you, you shall see it as you would a diamond at the bottom of your glass.
Bravo! Said Baisemeaux, and he poured out a great glass of wine and drank it off at a draught, trembling with joy at the idea of being, by hook or by crook, in the secret of some high archiepiscopal misdemeanor. While he was drinking he did not see with what attention Aramis was noting the sounds in the great court. A courier came in about 8 o'clock as Francois brought in the fifth bottle, and, although the courier made a great noise, Baisemeaux heard nothing.
The devil take him, said Aramis.
What?
Who?
Asked Baisemeaux. I hope 'tis neither the wine you drank nor he who is the cause of your drinking it.
No, it is a horse, who is making noise enough in the court for a whole squadron.
Pooh!
Some courier or other, replied the governor, redoubling his attention to the passing bottle.
Yes, and may the devil take him, and so quickly that we shall never hear him speak more.
Hurrah! Hurrah!
You forget me, Baisemeaux.
My glass is empty, said Aramis, lifting his dazzling Venetian goblet.
Upon my honor, you delight me.
Francois, wine.
Francois entered.
Wine, fellow.
And better.
Yes, monsieur, yes, but a courier has just arrived.
Let him go to the devil, I say.
Yes, monsieur, but.
Let him leave his news at the office, we will see to it tomorrow.
Tomorrow, there will be time tomorrow, there will be daylight, said Baisemeaux, chanting the words.
Ah, monsieur, grumbled the soldier Francois, in spite of himself, monsieur.
Take care, said Aramis, take care.
Of what?
Dear M.
d'Herblay, said Baisemeaux, half intoxicated.
The letter which the courier brings to the governor of a fortress is sometimes an order.
Nearly always.
Do not orders issue from the ministers?
Yes, undoubtedly, but.
And what do these ministers do but countersign the signature of the king?
Perhaps you are right.
Nevertheless, 'tis very tiresome when you are sitting before a good table, tête-à-tête with a friend.
I beg your pardon, monsieur, I forgot it is I who engage you at supper, and that I speak to a future cardinal.
Let us pass over that, dear Baisemeaux, and return to our soldier, to Francois.
Well, and what has Francois done?
He has demurred.
He was wrong, then?
However, he has demurred, you see, 'tis because there is something extraordinary in this matter. It is very possible that it was not Francois who was wrong in demurring, but you, who are in the wrong and not listening to him.
Wrong?
I to be wrong before Francois? That seems rather hard.
Pardon me, merely an irregularity. But I thought it my duty to make an observation which I deem important.
Oh! Perhaps you are right, stammered Baisemeaux. The king's order is sacred, but as to orders that arrive when one is at supper, I repeat that the devil.
if you had said as much to the great Cardinal Hem. My dear Baisemeaux, and if his order had any importance. I do it that I may not disturb a bishop. Mordieu! Am I not, then, excusable? Do not forget, Baisemeaux, that I have worn the soldier's coat, and I am accustomed to obedience everywhere. You'll wish, then. I wish that you will do your duty, my friend, yes, at least before this soldier. 'Tis mathematically true, exclaimed Baisemeaux. François still waited, let them send this order of the king's up to me, he repeated, recovering himself. And he added in a low tone, do you know what it is? I will tell you something about as interesting as this. Beware of fire near the powder magazine, or, look close after such and such a one, who is clever at escaping. Ah! If you only knew, Monseigneur, how many times I have been suddenly awakened from the very sweetest, deepest slumber, by messengers arriving at full gallop to tell me, or rather, bring me a slip of paper containing these words, Monsieur de Baisemeaux, what news? 'Tis clear enough that those who waste their time writing such orders have never slept in the Bastille. They would know better, they have never considered the thickness of my walls, the vigilance of my officers, the number of rounds we go. But, indeed, what can you expect, Monseigneur? It is their business to write and torment me when I am at rest, and to trouble me when I am happy, added Baisemeaux, bowing to Aramis. Then let them do their business. And do you do yours, added the bishop, smiling. François re-entered, Baisemeaux took from his hands the minister's order. He slowly undid it, and as slowly read it. Aramis pretended to be drinking, so as to be able to watch his host through the glass. Then, Baisemeaux, having read it, what was I just saying? He exclaimed. What is it? Asked the bishop. An order of release. There, now, excellent news indeed to disturb us. Excellent news for him whom it concerns, you will at least agree, my dear governor. And at 8 o'clock in the evening. It is charitable. Oh! Charity is all very well, but it is for that fellow who says he is so weary and tired, but not for me who am amusing myself, said Baisemeaux, exasperated. Will you lose by him, then? And is the prisoner who is to be set at liberty a good payer? Oh, yes, indeed. A miserable, 5-franc rat. Let me see it, asked Hem, durably. It is no indiscretion? By no means, read it. There is urgent, on the paper, you have seen that, I suppose? Oh, admirable. Urgent exclamation mark a man who has been there 10 years. It is urgent to set him free today, this very evening, at 8 o'clock, urgent. And Baisemeaux, shrugging his shoulders with an air of supreme disdain, flung the order on the table and began eating again. They are fond of these tricks. He said, with his mouth full, they seize a man, some fine day, keep him under lock and key for 10 years, and write to you, watch this fellow well, or keep him very strictly. And then, as soon as you are accustomed to look upon the prisoner as a dangerous man, all of a sudden, without rhyme or reason they write set him at liberty, and actually add to their missive urgent. You alone, my lord, 'tis enough to make a man at dinner shrug his shoulders. What do you expect? It is for them to write, said Aramis, for you to execute the order. Good. Good. Execute it. Oh, patience. You must not imagine that I am a slave. Gracious heaven! My very good M. Baisemeaux, whoever said so? Your independence is well known. Thank heaven! But your goodness of heart is also known. Ah! Don't speak of it. And your obedience to your superiors. Once a soldier, you see, Baisemeaux, always a soldier. And I shall directly obey, and tomorrow morning, at daybreak, the prisoner referred to shall be set free. Tomorrow? At dawn. Why not this evening, seeing that the lettre de cachet bears, both on the direction and inside, urgent question mark? Because this evening we are at supper, and our affairs are urgent, too. Dear Baisemeaux, booted though I be, I feel myself a priest, and charity has higher claims upon me than hunger and thirst. This unfortunate man has suffered long enough, since you have just told me that he has been your prisoner these 10 years. Abridge his suffering. His good time has come, give him the benefit quickly. God will repay you in paradise with years of felicity. You wish it? I entreat you. What? In the very middle of our repast? I implore you, such an action is worth 10 benedicits. It shall be as you desire, only our supper will get cold. Oh! Never heed that. Baisemeaux leaned back to ring for François, and by a very natural motion turned round towards the door. The order had remained on the table,
Aramis seized the opportunity when Baisemeaux was not looking to change the paper for another, folded in the same manner, which he drew swiftly from his pocket. "François," said the governor, "let the major come up here with the turnkeys of the Bertaudiere." François bowed and quitted the room, leaving the two companions alone. Chapter 8. The General of the Order. There was now a brief silence, during which Aramis never removed his eyes from Baisemeaux for a moment. The latter seemed only half decided to disturb himself thus in the middle of supper, and it was clear he was trying to invent some pretext, whether good or bad, for delay, at any rate till after dessert. And it appeared also that he had hit upon an excuse at last. "Eh! But it is impossible!" he cried. "How impossible?" said Aramis. "Give me a glimpse of this impossibility. 'Tis impossible to set a prisoner at liberty at such an hour. Where can he go to, a man so unacquainted with Paris? He will find a place wherever he can. You see, now, one might as well set a blind man free. I have a carriage, and will take him wherever he wishes. You have an answer for everything. François, tell Monsieur le Major to go and open the cell of M. Selden, number 3, Bertaudiere." "Selden!" exclaimed Aramis, very naturally. "You said Selden, I think?"
"I said Selden, of course. 'Tis the name of the man they set free."
"Oh! You mean to say Marchilly?" said Aramis. "Marchilly? Oh! Yes, indeed. No, no, Selden. I think you are making a mistake, Monsieur Baisemeaux. I have read the order. And I saw Selden in letters as large as that," and Baisemeaux held up his finger. "And I read Marchilly in characters as large as this," said Aramis, also holding up two fingers. "To the proof, let us throw a light on the matter," said Baisemeaux, confident he was right. "There is the paper, you have only to read it."
"I read Marchilly," returned Aramis, spreading out the paper. "Look."
Baisemeaux looked, and his arms dropped suddenly. "Yes, yes," he said, quite overwhelmed, "yes, Marchilly. 'Tis plainly written Marchilly. Quite true."
"Ah!
How? The man of whom we have talked so much? The man whom they are every day telling me to take such care of?"
"There is Marchilly," repeated the inflexible Aramis.